The Moonstone. Name equals Chapo 1. Prologue. The Storming of Seringapatam, 1799. Extracted from a family paper. I address these lines, written in India, to my relatives in England. My object is to explain the motive which has induced me to refuse the right hand of friendship to my cousin, John Herncastle. The reserve which I have hitherto maintained in this matter has been misinterpreted by members of my family whose good opinion I cannot consent to forfeit. I request them to suspend their decision until they have read my narrative. And I declare, on my word of honor, that what I am now about to write is, strictly and literally, the truth. The private difference between my cousin and me took its rise in a great public event in which we were both concerned, the storming of Seringapatam, under General Baird, on the 4th of May, 1799. In order that the circumstances may be clearly understood, I must revert for a moment to the period before the assault, and to the stories current in our camp of the treasure and jewels and gold stored up in the palace of Seringapatam. 2. One of the wildest of these stories related to a yellow diamond, a famous gem in the native annals of India. The earliest known traditions describe the stone as having been set in the forehead of the four-handed Indian god who typifies the moon. Partly from its peculiar color, partly from a superstition which represented it as feeling the influence of the deity whom it adorned, and growing and lessening in luster with the waxing and waning of the moon, it first gained the name by which it continues to be known in India to this day, the name of the Moonstone. A similar superstition was once prevalent, as I have heard, in ancient Greece and Rome, not applying, however, as in India, to a diamond devoted to the service of a god, but to a semi-transparent stone of the inferior order of gems, supposed to be affected by the lunar influences, the moon, in this latter case also, giving the name by which the stone is still known to collectors in our own time. The adventures of the yellow diamond begin with the 11th century of the Christian era. At that date, the Mohammedan conqueror, Mahmud of Ghizni, crossed India, seized on the holy city of Somnath, and stripped of its treasures the famous temple, which had stood for centuries, the shrine of Hindu pilgrimage, and the wonder of the Eastern world. Of all the deities worshipped in the temple, the moon god alone escaped the rapacity of the conquering Mohammedans. Preserved by three Brahmins, the inviolate deity, bearing the yellow diamond in its forehead, was removed by night, and was transported to the second of the sacred cities of India, the city of Benares. Here, in a new shrine, in a hall inlaid with precious stones, under a roof supported by pillars of gold, the moon god was set up and worshipped. Here, on the night when the shrine was completed, Vishnu the preserver appeared to the three Brahmins in a dream. The deity breathed the breath of his divinity on the diamond in the forehead of the god. And the Brahmins knelt and hid their faces in their robes. The deity commanded that the moonstone should be watched, from that time forth, by three priests in turn, night and day, to the end of the generations of men. And the Brahmins heard, and bowed before his will. The deity predicted certain disaster to the presumptuous mortal who laid hands on the sacred gem, and to all of his house and name who received it after him. And the Brahmins caused the prophecy to be written over the gates of the shrine in letters of gold. One age followed another, and still, generation after generation, the successors of the three Brahmins watched their priceless moonstone, night and day. One age followed another until the first years of the 18th Christian century saw the reign of Aurangzeb, emperor of the Mughals. At his command havoc and rapine were let loose once more among the temples of the worship of Brahma. The shrine of the four-handed god was polluted by the slaughter of sacred animals, the images of the deities were broken in pieces, and the moonstone was seized by an officer of rank in the army of Aurangzeb. Powerless to recover their lost treasure by open force, the three guardian priests followed and watched it in disguise. The generations succeeded each other, the warrior who had committed the sacrilege perished miserably, the moonstone passed, carrying its curse with it, from one lawless Mohammedan hand to another, and still, through all chances and changes, the successors of the three guardian priests kept their watch, waiting the day when the will of Vishnu the preserver should restore to them their sacred gem. Time rolled on from the first to the last years of the 18th Christian century. The diamond fell into the possession of Tipu, Sultan of Seringapatam, who caused it to be placed as an ornament in the handle of a dagger, and who commanded it to be kept among the choicest treasures of his armory. Even then, in the palace of the Sultan himself, the three guardian priests still kept their watch in secret. There were three officers of Tipu's household, strangers to the rest, who had won their master's confidence by conforming, or appearing to conform, to the Muslim faith, and to those three men report pointed as the three priests in disguise. 3. So, as told in our camp, ran the fanciful story of the Moonstone. It made no serious impression on any of us except my cousin, whose love of the marvelous induced him to believe it. On the night before the assault on Seringapatam, he was absurdly angry with me, and with others, for treating the whole thing as a fable. A foolish wrangle followed, and Herncastle's unlucky temper got the better of him. He declared, in his boastful way, that we should see the diamond on his finger, if the English army took Seringapatam. The sally was saluted by a roar of laughter, and there, as we all thought that night, the thing ended. Let me now take you on to the day of the assault. My cousin and I were separated at the outset. I never saw him when we forded the river, when we planted the English flag in the first breach, when we crossed the ditch beyond, and, fighting every inch of our way, entered the town. It was only at dusk, when the place was ours, and after General Baird himself had found the dead body of Tipu under a heap of the slain, that Herncastle and I met. We were each attached to a party sent out by the general's orders to prevent the plunder and confusion which followed our conquest. The camp followers committed deplorable excesses, and, worse still, the soldiers found their way, by a guarded door, into the treasury of the palace, and loaded themselves with gold and jewels. It was in the court outside the treasury that my cousin and I met, to enforce the laws of discipline on our own soldiers. Herncastle's fiery temper had been, as I could plainly see, exasperated to a kind of frenzy by the terrible slaughter through which we had passed. He was very unfit, in my opinion, to perform the duty that had been entrusted to him. There was riot and confusion enough in the treasury, but no violence that I saw. The men, if I may use such an expression, disgraced themselves good-humoredly. All sorts of rough jests and catchwords were bandied about among them, and the story of the diamond turned up again unexpectedly, in the form of a mischievous joke. Who's got the moonstone? Was the rallying cry which perpetually caused the plundering, as soon as it was stopped in one place, to break out in another? While I was still vainly trying to establish order, I heard a frightful yelling on the other side of the courtyard, and at once ran towards the cries, in dread of finding some new outbreak of the pillage in the direction. I got to an open door, and saw the bodies of two Indians, by their dress, as I guessed, officers of the palace, lying across the entrance, dead. A cry inside hurried me into a room, which appeared to serve as an armory. A third Indian, mortally wounded, was sinking at the feet of a man whose back was towards me. The man turned at the instant when I came in, and I saw John Herncastle, with a torch in one hand, and a dagger dripping with blood in the other. A stone, set like a pommel, in the end of the dagger's handle, flashed in the torchlight, as he turned on me, like a gleam of fire. The dying Indian sank to his knees, pointed to the dagger in Herncastle's hand, and said, in his native language, "The moonstone will have its vengeance yet on you and yours." He spoke those words, and fell dead on the floor. Before I could stir in the matter, the men who had followed me across the courtyard crowded in. My cousin rushed to meet them, like a madman. "Clear the room!" he shouted to me, and set a guard on the door. The men fell back as he threw himself on them with his torch and his dagger. I put two sentinels of my own company, on whom I could rely, to keep the door. Through the remainder of the night, I saw no more of my cousin. Early in the morning, the plunder still going on, General Baird announced publicly by beat of drum, that any thief detected in the fact, be he whom he might, should be hung. The provost marshal was in attendance, to prove that the general was in earnest, and in the throng that followed the proclamation, Herncastle and I met again. He held out his hand, as usual, and said, "Good morning." I waited before I gave him my hand in return. "Tell me first," I said, "how the Indian in the armory met his death, and what those last words meant, when he pointed to the dagger in your hand." "The Indian met his death, as I suppose, by a mortal wound," said Herncastle. "What his last words meant I know no more than you do." I looked at him narrowly. His frenzy of the previous day had all calmed down. I determined to give him another chance. "Is that all you have to tell me?" I asked. He answered, "That is all." I turned my back on him, and we have not spoken since. 4. I beg it to be understood that what I write here about my cousin, unless some necessity should arise for making it public, is for the information of the family only. Herncastle has said nothing that can justify me in speaking to our commanding officer. He has been taunted more than once about the diamond, by those who recollect his angry outbreak before the assault, but, as may easily be imagined, his own remembrance of the circumstances under which I surprised him in the armory has been enough to keep him silent. It is reported that he means to exchange into another regiment, avowedly for the purpose of separating himself from me. Whether this be true or not, I cannot prevail upon myself to become his accuser, and I think with good reason. If I made the matter public, I have no evidence but moral evidence to bring forward. I have not only no proof that he killed the two men at the door, I cannot even declare that he killed the third man inside, for I cannot say that my own eyes saw the deed committed. It is true that I heard the dying Indian's words, but if those words were pronounced to be the ravings of delirium, how could I contradict the assertion from my own knowledge? Let our relatives, on either side, form their own opinion on what I have written, and decide for themselves whether the aversion I now feel towards this man is well or ill-founded. Although I attach no sort of credit to the fantastic Indian legend of the gem, I must acknowledge, before I conclude, that I am influenced by a certain superstition of my own in this matter. It is my conviction, or my delusion, no matter which, that crime brings its own fatality with it. I am not only persuaded of Herncastle's guilt, I am even fanciful enough to believe that he will live to regret it, if he keeps the diamond, and that others will live to regret taking it from him, if he gives the diamond away. Name equals Chapo 2. The story. Name equals Chapo 3. First period. The loss of the diamond, 1848. The events related by Gabriel Betteridge, house steward in the service of Julia, Lady Verinder. Name equals Chapo 4. Chapter 1. In the first part of Robinson Crusoe, at page 129, you will find it thus written. Now I saw, though too late, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost, and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it. Only yesterday, I opened my Robinson Crusoe at that place. Only this morning, May 21, 1850, came my lady's nephew, Mr. Franklin Blake, and held a short conversation with me, as follows. Betteridge, says Mr. Franklin, I have been to the lawyers about some family matters, and, among other things, we have been talking of the loss of the Indian diamond, in my aunt's house in Yorkshire, 2 years since. Mr. Bruff thinks, as I think, that the whole story ought, in the interests of truth, to be placed on record in writing, and the sooner the better. Not perceiving his drift yet, and thinking it always desirable for the sake of peace and quietness to be on the lawyer's side, I said I thought so too. Mr. Franklin went on. In this matter of the diamond, he said, the characters of innocent people have suffered under suspicion already, as you know. The memories of innocent people may suffer, hereafter, for want of a record of the facts to which those who come after us can appeal. There can be no doubt that this strange family story of ours ought to be told. And I think, Betteridge, Mr. Bruff and I together have hit on the right way of telling it. Very satisfactory to both of them, no doubt. But I fail to see what I myself had to do with it, so far. We have certain events to relate, Mr. Franklin proceeded, and we have certain persons concerned in those events who are capable of relating them. Starting from these plain facts, the idea is that we should all write the story of the Moonstone in turn, as far as our own personal experience extends, and no farther. We must begin by showing how the diamond first fell into the hands of my uncle Herncastle, when he was serving in India 50 years since. This prefatory narrative I have already got by me in the form of an old family paper, which relates the necessary particulars on the authority of an eyewitness. The next thing to do is to tell how the diamond found its way into my aunt's house in Yorkshire, 2 years ago, and how it came to be lost in little more than 12 hours afterwards. Nobody knows as much as you do, Betteridge, about what went on in the house at that time. So you must take the pen in hand, and start the story. In those terms I was informed of what my personal concern was with the matter of the diamond. If you are curious to know what course I took under the circumstances, I beg to inform you that I did what you would probably have done in my place. I modestly declared myself to be quite unequal to the task imposed upon me, and I privately felt, all the time, that I was quite clever enough to perform it, if I only gave my own abilities a fair chance. Mr. Franklin, I imagine, must have seen my private sentiments in my face. He declined to believe in my modesty, and he insisted on giving my abilities a fair chance. 2 hours have passed since Mr. Franklin left me. As soon as his back was turned, I went to my writing desk to start the story. There I have sat helpless, in spite of my abilities, ever since, seeing what Robinson Crusoe saw, as quoted above, namely, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost, and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it. Please to remember, I opened the book by accident, at that bit, only the day before I rashly undertook the business now in hand, and, allow me to ask, if that isn't prophecy, what is? I am not superstitious, I have read a heap of books in my time, I am a scholar in my own way. Though turned 70, I possess an active memory, and legs to correspond. You are not to take it, if you please, as the saying of an ignorant man, When I express my opinion that such a book as Robinson Crusoe never was written, and never will be written again. I have tried that book for years, generally in combination with a pipe of tobacco, and I have found it my friend in need in all the necessities of this mortal life. When my spirits are bad, Robinson Crusoe. When I want advice, Robinson Crusoe. In past times when my wife plagued me, in present times when I have had a drop too much, Robinson Crusoe. I have worn out 6 stout Robinson Crusoes with hard work in my service. On my lady's last birthday she gave me a 7th. I took a drop too much on the strength of it, and Robinson Crusoe put me right again. Price 4 shillings and 6 pence, bound in blue, with a picture into the bargain. Still, this don't look much like starting the story of the diamond, does it? I seem to be wandering off in search of Lord knows what, Lord knows where. We will take a new sheet of paper, if you please, and begin over again, with my best respects to you. Name equals Chapo 5. Chapter 2. I spoke of my lady a line or two back. Now the diamond could never have been in our house, where it was lost, if it had not been made a present of to my lady's daughter, and my lady's daughter would never have been in existence to have the present, if it had not been for my lady who, with pain and travail, produced her into the world. Consequently, if we begin with my lady, we are pretty sure of beginning far enough back. And that, let me tell you, when you have got such a job as mine in hand, is a real comfort at starting. If you know anything of the fashionable world, you have heard tell of the 3 beautiful Miss Herncastles. Miss Adelaide, Miss Caroline, and Miss Julia, this last being the youngest and the best of the 3 sisters, in my opinion, and I had opportunities of judging, as you shall presently see. I went into the service of the old lord, their father. Thank God, we have got nothing to do with him, in this business of the diamond. He had the longest tongue and the shortest temper of any man, high or low, I ever met with. I say, I went into the service of the old lord, as page boy in waiting on the 3 honorable young ladies, at the age of 15 years. There I lived till Miss Julia married the late Sir John Verinder. An excellent man, who only wanted somebody to manage him, and, between ourselves, he found somebody to do it, and what is more, he throve on it and grew fat on it, and lived happy and died easy on it, dating from the day when my lady took him to church to be married, to the day when she relieved him of his last breath, and closed his eyes forever. I have omitted to state that I went with the bride to the bride's husband's house in Lansdowne here. Sir John, she says, I can't do without Gabriel Betteridge. My lady, says Sir John, I can't do without him, either. That was his way with her, and that was how I went into his service. It was all one to me where I went, so long as my mistress and I were together. Seeing that my lady took an interest in the out-of-door work, and the farms, and such like, I took an interest in them too, with all the more reason that I was a small farmer's 7th son myself. My lady got me put under the bailiff, and I did my best, and gave satisfaction, and got promotion accordingly. Some years later, on the Monday as it might be, my lady says, Sir John, your bailiff is a stupid old man. Pension him liberally, and let Gabriel Betteridge have his place. On the Tuesday as it might be, Sir John says, my lady, the bailiff is pensioned liberally, and Gabriel Betteridge has got his place. You hear more than enough of married people living together miserably. Here is an example to the contrary. Let it be a warning to some of you, and an encouragement to others. In the meantime, I will go on with my story. Well, there I was in clover, you will say. Placed in a position of trust and honor, with a little cottage of my own to live in, with my rounds on the estate to occupy me in the morning, and my accounts in the afternoon, and my pipe and my Robinson Crusoe in the evening, what more could I possibly want to make me happy? Remember what Adam wanted when he was alone in the Garden of Eden, and if you don't blame it in Adam, don't blame it in me. The woman I fixed my eye on, was the woman who kept house for me at my cottage. Her name was Selina Gobie. I agree with the late William Cobbett about picking a wife. See that she chews her food well and sets her foot down firmly on the ground when she walks, and you're all right. Selina Gobie was all right in both these respects, which was one reason for marrying her. I had another reason, likewise, entirely of my own discovering. Selina, being a single woman, made me pay so much a week for her board and services. Selina, being my wife, couldn't charge for her board, and would have to give me her services for nothing. That was the point of view I looked at it from. Economy, with a dash of love. I put it to my mistress, as in duty bound, just as I had put it to myself. I have been turning Selina Gobie over in my mind, I said, and I think, my lady, it will be cheaper to marry her than to keep her. My lady burst out laughing, and said she didn't know which to be most shocked at, my language or my principles. Some joke tickled her, I suppose, of the sort that you can't take unless you are a person of quality. Understanding nothing myself but that I was free to put it next to Selena, I went and put it accordingly. And what did Selena say? Lord! How little you must know of women, if you ask that. Of course she said, yes. As my time drew nearer, and there got to be talk of my having a new coat for the ceremony, my mind began to misgive me. I have compared notes with other men as to what they felt while they were in my interesting situation, and they have all acknowledged that, about a week before it happened, they privately wished themselves out of it. I went a trifle further than that myself. I actually rose up, as it were, and tried to get out of it. Not for nothing. I was too just a man to expect she would let me off for nothing. Compensation to the woman when the man gets out of it, is one of the laws of England. In obedience to the laws, and after turning it over carefully in my mind, I offered Selena Gobie a feather bed and 50 shillings to be off the bargain. You will hardly believe it, but it is nevertheless true, she was fool enough to refuse. After that it was all over with me, of course. I got the new coat as cheap as I could, and I went through all the rest of it as cheap as I could. We were not a happy couple, and not a miserable couple. We were 6 of one and 6 dozen of the other. How it was I don't understand, but we always seemed to be getting, with the best of motives, in one another's way. When I wanted to go upstairs, there was my wife coming down, or when my wife wanted to go down, there was I coming up. That is married life, according to my experience of it. After 5 years of misunderstandings on the stairs, it pleased an all-wise providence to relieve us of each other by taking my wife. I was left with my little girl Penelope, and with no other child. Shortly afterwards Sir John died, and my lady was left with her little girl, Miss Rachel, and no other child. I have a written to very poor purpose of my lady, if you require to be told that my little Penelope was taken care of, under my good mistress's own eye, and was sent to school and taught, and made a sharp girl, and promoted, when old enough, to be Miss Rachel's own maid. As for me, I went on with my business as bailiff year after year up to Christmas 1847, when there came a change in my life. On that day, my lady invited herself to a cup of tea alone with me in my cottage. She remarked that, reckoning from the year when I started as page boy in the time of the old lord, I had been more than 50 years in her service, and she put into my hands a beautiful waistcoat of wool that she had worked herself, to keep me warm in the bitter winter weather. I received this magnificent present quite at a loss to find words to thank my mistress with for the honor she had done me. To my great astonishment, it turned out, however, that the waistcoat was not an honor, but a bribe. My lady had discovered that I was getting old before I had discovered it myself, and she had come to my cottage to wheedle me, if I may use such an expression, into giving up my hard out-of-door work as bailiff, and taking my ease for the rest of my days as steward in the house. I made as good a fight of it against the indignity of taking my ease as I could. But my mistress knew the weak side of me, she put it as a favor to herself. The dispute between us ended, after that, in my wiping my eyes, like an old fool, with my new woolen waistcoat, and saying I would think about it. The perturbation in my mind, in regard to thinking about it, being truly dreadful after my lady had gone away, I applied the remedy which I have never yet found to fail me in cases of doubt and emergency. I smoked a pipe and took a turn at Robinson Crusoe. Before I had occupied myself with that extraordinary book 5 minutes, I came on a comforting bit, page 158, as follows: today we love, what tomorrow we hate. I saw my way clear directly. Today I was all for continuing to be farm bailiff, tomorrow, on the authority of Robinson Crusoe, I should be all the other way. Take myself tomorrow while in tomorrow's humor, and the thing was done. My mind being relieved in this manner, I went to sleep that night in the character of Lady Verinder's farm bailiff, and I woke up the next morning in the character of Lady Verinder's house steward. All quite comfortable, and all through Robinson Crusoe. My daughter Penelope has just looked over my shoulder to see what I have done so far. She remarks that it is beautifully written, and every word of it true. But she points out one objection. She says what I have done so far isn't in the least what I was wanted to do. I am asked to tell the story of the diamond and, instead of that, I have been telling the story of my own self. Curious, and quite beyond me to account for. I wonder whether the gentlemen who make a business and a living out of writing books, ever find their own selves getting in the way of their subjects, like me? If they do, I can feel for them. In the meantime, here is another false start, and more waste of good writing paper. What's to be done now? Nothing that I know of, except for you to keep your temper, and for me to begin it all over again for the third time. Name equals Chap 06. Chapter 3. The question of how I am to start the story properly I have tried to settle in two ways. First, by scratching my head, which led to nothing. Second, by consulting my daughter Penelope, which has resulted in an entirely new idea. Penelope's notion is that I should set down what happened, regularly day by day, beginning with the day when we got the news that Mr. Franklin Blake was expected on a visit to the house. When you come to fix your memory with a date in this way, it is wonderful what your memory will pick up for you upon that compulsion. The only difficulty is to fetch out the dates, in the first place. This Penelope offers to do for me by looking into her own diary, which she was taught to keep when she was at school, and which she has gone on keeping ever since. In answer to an improvement on this notion, devised by myself, namely, that she should tell the story instead of me, out of her own diary, Penelope observes, with a fierce look and a red face, that her journal is for her own private eye, and that no living creature shall ever know what is in it but herself. When I inquire what this means, Penelope says, "Fiddlesticks." I say, "Sweethearts." Beginning, then, on Penelope's plan, I beg to mention that I was specially called one Wednesday morning into my lady's own sitting room, the date being the 24th of May, 1848. "Gabriel," says my lady, "here is news that will surprise you. Franklin Blake has come back from abroad. He has been staying with his father in London, and he is coming to us tomorrow to stop till next month, and keep Rachel's birthday." If I had had a hat in my hand, nothing but respect would have prevented me from throwing that hat up to the ceiling. I had not seen Mr. Franklin since he was a boy, living along with us in this house. He was, out of all sight, as I remember him, the nicest boy that ever spun a top or broke a window. Miss Rachel, who was present, and to whom I made that remark, observed, in return, that she remembered him as the most atrocious tyrant that ever tortured a doll, and the hardest driver of an exhausted little girl in string harness that England could produce. "I burn with indignation, and I ache with fatigue," was the way Miss Rachel summed it up, "when I think of Franklin Blake." Hearing what I now tell you, you will naturally ask how it was that Mr. Franklin should have passed all the years, from the time when he was a boy to the time when he was a man, out of his own country. I answer, because his father had the misfortune to be next heir to a dukedom, and not to be able to prove it. In two words, this was how the thing happened. My lady's eldest sister married the celebrated Mr. Blake, equally famous for his great riches, and his great suit at law. How many years he went on worrying the tribunals of his country to turn out the Duke in possession, and to put himself in the Duke's place, how many lawyers' purses he filled to bursting, and how many otherwise harmless people he set by the years together disputing whether he was right or wrong, is more by a great deal than I can reckon up. His wife died, and two of his three children died, before the tribunals could make up their minds to show him the door and take no more of his money. When it was all over, and the Duke in possession was left in possession, Mr. Blake discovered that the only way of being even with his country for the manner in which it had treated him, was not to let his country have the honor of educating his son. "How can I trust my native institutions," was the form in which he put it, "after the way in which my native institutions have behaved to me?" Add to this, that Mr. Blake disliked all boys, his own included, and you will admit that it could only end in one way. Master Franklin was taken from us in England, and was sent to institutions which his father could trust, in that superior country, Germany, Mr. Blake himself, you will observe, remaining snug in England, to improve his fellow countrymen in the Parliament House, and to publish a statement on the subject of the Duke in possession, which has remained an unfinished statement from that day to this. There. Thank God, that's told. Neither you nor I need trouble our heads any more about Mr. Blake, Senior. Leave him to the dukedom, and let you and I stick to the diamond. The diamond takes us back to Mr. Franklin, who was the innocent means of bringing that unlucky jewel into the house. Our nice boy didn't forget us after he went abroad. He wrote every now and then, sometimes to my lady, sometimes to Miss Rachel, and sometimes to me. We had had a transaction together, before he left, which consisted in his borrowing of me a ball of string, a four-bladed knife, and 7 and 6 pence in money, the color of which last I have not seen, and never expect to see again. His letters to me chiefly related to borrowing more. I heard, however, from my lady, how he got on abroad, as he grew in years and stature. After he had learned what the institutions of Germany could teach him, he gave the French a turn next, and the Italians a turn after that. They made him among them a sort of universal genius, as well as I could understand it. He wrote a little, he painted a little, he sang and played and composed a little, borrowing, as I suspect, in all these cases, just as he had borrowed from me. His mother's fortune, 700 a year, fell to him when he came of age, and ran through him, as it might be through a sieve. The more money he had, the more he wanted. There was a hole in Mr. Franklin's pocket that nothing would sew up. Wherever he went, the lively, easy way of him made him welcome. He lived here, there, and everywhere, his address, as he used to put it himself, being post office, Europe, to be left till called for. Twice over, he made up his mind to come back to England and see us, and twice over, saving your presence, some unmentionable woman stood in the way and stopped him. His third attempt succeeded, as you know already from what my lady told me. On Thursday the 25th of May, we were to see for the first time what our nice boy had grown to be as a man. He came of good blood, he had a high courage, and he was 25 years of age, by our reckoning. Now you know as much of Mr. Franklin Blake as I did, before Mr. Franklin Blake came down to our house. The Thursday was as fine a summer's day as ever you saw, and my lady and Miss Rachel, not expecting Mr. Franklin till dinner time, drove out to lunch with some friends in the neighborhood. When they were gone, I went and had a look at the bedroom which had been got ready for our guest, and saw that all was straight. Then, being butler in my lady's establishment, as well as steward, at my own particular request, mind, and because it vexed me to see anybody but myself in possession of the key of the late Sir John's cellar, then, I say, I fetched up some of our famous liqueur claret, and set it in the warm summer air to take off the chill before dinner. Concluding to set myself in the warm summer air next, seeing that what is good for old claret is equally good for old age, I took up my beehive chair to go out into the back court, when I was stopped by hearing a sound like the soft beating of a drum, on the terrace in front of my lady's residence. Going round to the terrace, I found three mahogany-colored Indians, in white linen frocks and trousers, looking up at the house. The Indians, as I saw on looking closer, had small hand drums slung in front of them. Behind them stood a little delicate-looking light-haired English boy carrying a bag. I judged the fellows to be strolling conjurers, and the boy with the bag to be carrying the tools of their trade. One of the three, who spoke English and who exhibited, I must own, the most elegant manners, presently informed me that my judgment was right. He requested permission to show his tricks in the presence of the lady of the house. Now I am not a sour old man. I am generally all for amusement, and the last person in the world to distrust another person because he happens to be a few shades darker than myself. But the best of us have our weaknesses, and my weakness, when I know a family plate basket to be out on a pantry table, is to be instantly reminded of that basket by the sight of a strolling stranger whose manners are superior to my own. I accordingly informed the Indian that the lady of the house was out, and I warned him and his party off the premises. He made me a beautiful bow in return, and he and his party went off the premises. On my side, I returned to my beehive chair, and set myself down on the sunny side of the court, and fell, if the truth must be owned, not exactly into a sleep, but into the next best thing to it. I was roused up by my daughter Penelope running out at me as if the house was on fire. What do you think she wanted? She wanted to have the three Indian jugglers instantly taken up, for this reason, namely, that they knew who was coming from London to visit us, and that they meant some mischief to Mr. Franklin Blake. Mr. Franklin's name roused me. I opened my eyes, and made my girl explain herself. It appeared that Penelope had just come from our lodge, where she had been having a gossip with the lodge keeper's daughter. The two girls had seen the Indians pass out, after I had warned them off, followed by their little boy. Taking it into their heads that the boy was ill-used by the foreigners, for no reason that I could discover, except that he was pretty and delicate-looking, the two girls had stolen along the inner side of the hedge between us and the road, and had watched the proceedings of the foreigners on the outer side. Those proceedings resulted in the performance of the following extraordinary tricks. They first looked up the road, and down the road, and made sure that they were alone. Then they all three faced about, and stared hard in the direction of our house. Then they jabbered and disputed in their own language, and looked at each other like men in doubt. Then they all turned to their little English boy, as if they expected him to help them. And then the chief Indian, who spoke English, said to the boy, "Hold out your hand." On hearing those dreadful words, my daughter Penelope said she didn't know what prevented her heart from flying straight out of her. I thought privately that it might have been her stays. All I said, however, was, "You make my flesh creep." Nota bene, women like these little compliments. Well, when the Indian said, "Hold out your hand," the boy shrunk back, and shook his head, and said he didn't like it. The Indian, thereupon, asked him, not at all unkindly, whether he would like to be sent back to London, and left where they had found him, sleeping in an empty basket in a market, a hungry, ragged, and forsaken little boy. This, it seems, ended the difficulty. The little chap unwillingly held out his hand. Upon that, The Indian took a bottle from his bosom, and poured out of it some black stuff, like ink, into the palm of the boy's hand. The Indian, first touching the boy's head, and making signs over it in the air, then said, "Look." The boy became quite stiff, and stood like a statue, looking into the ink in the hollow of his hand. So far, it seemed to me to be juggling, accompanied by a foolish waste of ink. I was beginning to feel sleepy again, when Penelope's next words stirred me up. The Indians looked up the road and down the road once more, and then the chief Indian said these words to the boy, "See the English gentleman from foreign parts." The boy said, "I see him." The Indian said, "Is it on the road to this house, and on no other, that the English gentleman will travel today?" The boy said, "It is on the road to this house, and on no other, that the English gentleman will travel today." The Indian put a second question, after waiting a little first. He said, "Has the English gentleman got it about him?" The boy answered, also, after waiting a little first, "Yes." The Indian put a third and last question, "Will the English gentleman come here, as he has promised to come, at the close of day?" The boy said, "I can't tell." The Indian asked why. The boy said, "I am tired. The mist rises in my head, and puzzles me. I can see no more today." With that the catechism ended. The chief Indian said something in his own language to the other two, pointing to the boy, and pointing towards the town, in which, as we afterwards discovered, they were lodged. He then, after making more signs on the boy's head, blew on his forehead, and so woke him up with a start. After that, they all went on their way towards the town, and the girls saw them no more. Most things they say have a moral, if you only look for it. What was the moral of this? The moral was, as I thought, first, that the chief juggler had heard Mr. Franklin's arrival talked of among the servants out of doors, and saw his way to making a little money by it. Second, that he and his men and boy, with a view to making the said money, meant to hang about till they saw my lady drive home, and then to come back, and foretell Mr. Franklin's arrival by magic. Third, that Penelope had heard them rehearsing their hocus pocus, like actors rehearsing a play. Fourth, that I should do well to have an eye, that evening, on the plate basket. Fifth, that Penelope would do well to cool down, and leave me, her father, to doze off again in the sun. That appeared to me to be the sensible view. If you know anything of the ways of young women, you won't be surprised to hear that Penelope wouldn't take it. The moral of the thing was serious, according to my daughter. She particularly reminded me of the Indian's third question, "Has the English gentleman got it about him?" "Oh, father," says Penelope, clasping her hands, "don't joke about this. What does it mean?" "We'll ask Mr. Franklin, my dear," I said, "if you can wait till Mr. Franklin comes." I winked to show I meant that in joke. Penelope took it quite seriously. My girl's earnestness tickled me. "What on earth should Mr. Franklin know about it?" I inquired. "Ask him," says Penelope. "And see whether he thinks it a laughing matter, too." With that parting shot, my daughter left me. I settled it with myself, when she was gone, that I really would ask Mr. Franklin, mainly to set Penelope's mind at rest. What was said between us, when I did ask him, later on that same day, you will find set out fully in its proper place. But as I don't wish to raise your expectations and then disappoint them, I will take leave to warn you here, before we go any further, that you won't find the ghost of a joke in our conversation on the subject of the jugglers. To my great surprise, Mr. Franklin, like Penelope, took the thing seriously. How seriously, you will understand, when I tell you that, in his opinion, it meant the moonstone. Name equals Chapo 7. Chapter 4. I am truly sorry to detain you over me and my beehive chair. A sleepy old man, in a sunny backyard, is not an interesting object, I am well aware. But things must be put down in their places, as things actually happened, and you must please to jog on a little while longer with me, in expectation of Mr. Franklin Blake's arrival later in the day. Before I had time to doze off again, after my daughter Penelope had left me, I was disturbed by a rattling of plates and dishes in the servants' hall, which meant that dinner was ready. Taking my own meals in my own sitting room, I had nothing to do with the servants' dinner, except to wish them a good stomach to it all round, previous to composing myself once more in my chair. I was just stretching my legs, when out bounced another woman on me. Not my daughter again, only Nancy, the kitchen maid, this time. I was straight in her way out, and I observed, as she asked me to let her by, that she had a sulky face, a thing which, as head of the servants, I never allow, on principle, to pass me without inquiry. "What are you turning your back on your dinner for?" I asked. "What's wrong now, Nancy?" Nancy tried to push by, without answering, upon which I rose up, and took her by the ear. She is a nice plump young lass, and it is customary with me to adopt that manner of showing that I personally approve of a girl. What's wrong now? I said once more. Roseanne is late again for dinner, says Nancy. And I'm sent to fetch her in. All the hard work falls on my shoulders in this house. Let me alone, Mr. Betteridge. The person here mentioned as Rosanna was our second housemaid. Having a kind of pity for our second housemaid, why, you shall presently know, and seeing in Nancy's face, that she would fetch her fellow servant in with more hard words than might be needful under the circumstances, it struck me that I had nothing particular to do, and that I might as well fetch Rosanna myself, giving her a hint to be punctual in future, which I knew she would take kindly from me. Where is Rosanna? I inquired. At the Sands, of course, says Nancy, with a toss of her head. She had another of her fainting fits this morning, and she asked to go out and get a breath of fresh air. I have no patience with her. Go back to your dinner, my girl, I said. I have patience with her, and I'll fetch her in. Nancy, who has a fine appetite, looked pleased. When she looks pleased, she looks nice. When she looks nice, I chuck her under the chin. It isn't immorality, it's only habit. Well, I took my stick, and set off for the Sands. No. It won't do to set off yet. I am sorry again to detain you, but you really must hear the story of the Sands, and the story of Rosanna, for this reason, that the matter of the diamond touches them both nearly. How hard I try to get on with my statement without stopping by the way, and how badly I succeed. But, there. Persons and things do turn up so vexatiously in this life, and will in a manner insist on being noticed. Let us take it easy, and let us take it short, we shall be in the thick of the mystery soon, I promise you. Rosanna, to put the person before the thing, which is but common politeness, was the only new servant in our house. About 4 months before the time I am writing of, my lady had been in London, and had gone over a reformatory, intended to save forlorn women from drifting back into bad ways, after they had got released from prison. The matron, seeing my lady took an interest in the place, pointed out a girl to her, named Rosanna Spearman, and told her a most miserable story, which I haven't the heart to repeat here, for I don't like to be made wretched without any use, and no more do you. The upshot of it was, that Rosanna Spearman had been a thief, and not being of the sort that get up companies in the city, and rob from thousands, instead of only robbing from one, the law laid hold of her, and the prison and the reformatory followed the lead of the law. The matron's opinion of Rosanna was, in spite of what she had done, that the girl was one in a thousand, and that she only wanted a chance to prove herself worthy of any Christian woman's interest in her. My lady, being a Christian woman, if ever there was one yet, said to the matron, upon that, Rosanna Spearman shall have her chance, in my service. In a week afterwards, Rosanna Spearman entered this establishment as our second housemaid. Not a soul was told the girl's story, excepting Miss Rachel and me. My lady, doing me the honor to consult me about most things, consulted me about Rosanna. Having fallen a good deal latterly into the late Sir John's way of always agreeing with my lady, I agreed with her heartily about Rosanna Spearman. A fairer chance no girl could have had than was given to this poor girl of ours. None of the servants could cast her past life in her teeth, for none of the servants knew what it had been. She had her wages and her privileges, like the rest of them, and every now and then a friendly word from my lady, in private, to encourage her. In return, she showed herself, I am bound to say, well worthy of the kind treatment bestowed upon her. Though far from strong, and troubled occasionally with those fainting fits already mentioned, she went about her work modestly and uncomplainingly, doing it carefully, and doing it well. But, somehow, she failed to make friends among the other women servants, excepting my daughter Penelope, who was always kind to Rosanna, though never intimate with her. I hardly know what the girl did to offend them. There was certainly no beauty about her to make the others envious. She was the plainest woman in the house, with the additional misfortune of having one shoulder bigger than the other. What the servants chiefly resented, I think, was her silent tongue and her solitary ways. She read or worked in leisure hours when the rest gossiped. And when it came to her turn to go out, 9 times out of 10 she quietly put on her bonnet, and had her turn by herself. She never quarreled, she never took offense, she only kept a certain distance, obstinately and civilly, between the rest of them and herself. Add to this that, plain as she was, there was just a dash of something that wasn't like a housemaid, and that was like a lady, about her. It might have been in her voice, or it might have been in her face. All I can say is, that the other women pounced on it like lightning the first day she came into the house, and said, which was most unjust, that Rosanna Spearman gave herself airs. Having now told the story of Rosanna, I have only to notice one of the many queer ways of this strange girl to get on next to the story of the Sands. Our house is high up on the Yorkshire coast, and close by the sea. We have got beautiful walks all round us, in every direction but one. That one I acknowledge to be a Horne walk. It leads, for a quarter of a mile, through a melancholy plantation of firs, and brings you out between low cliffs on the loneliest and ugliest little bay on all our coast. The sandhills here run down to the sea, and end in two spits of rock jutting out opposite each other, till you lose sight of them in the water. One is called the North Spit, and one the South. Between the two, shifting backwards and forwards at certain seasons of the year, lies the most horrible quicksand on the shores of Yorkshire. At the turn of the tide, something goes on in the unknown deeps below, which sets the whole face of the quicksand shivering and trembling in a manner most remarkable to see, and which has given to it, among the people in our parts, the name of the Shivering Sand. A great bank, half a mile out, nigh the mouth of the bay, breaks the force of the main ocean coming in from the offing. Winter and summer, when the tide flows over the quicksand, the sea seems to leave the waves behind it on the bank, and rolls its waters in smoothly with a heave, and covers the sand in silence. A lonesome and a horrid retreat, I can tell you. No boat ever ventures into this bay. No children from our fishing village, called Cobb's Hole, ever come here to play. The very birds of the air, as it seems to me, give the Shivering Sand a wide berth. That a young woman, with dozens of nice walks to choose from, and company to go with her, if she only said come, should prefer this place, and should sit and work or read in it, all alone, when it's her turn out, I grant you, passes belief. It's true, nevertheless, account for it as you may, that this was Rosanna Spearman's favorite walk, except when she went once or twice to Cobb's Hole, to see the only friend she had in our neighborhood, of whom more anon. It's also true that I was now setting out for this same place, to fetch the girl into dinner, which brings us round happily to our former point, and starts us fair again on our way to the sands. I saw no sign of the girl in the plantation. When I got out, through the sandhills, onto the beach, there she was, in her little straw bonnet, and her plain grey cloak that she always wore to hide her deformed shoulder as much as might be, there she was, all alone, looking out on the quicksand and the sea. She started when I came up with her, and turned her head away from me. Not looking me in the face being another of the proceedings, which, as head of the servants, I never allow, on principle, to pass without inquiry, I turned her round my way, and saw that she was crying. My bandana handkerchief, one of six beauties given to me by my lady, was handy in my pocket. I took it out, and I said to Rosanna, "Come and sit down, my dear, on the slope of the beach along with me. I'll dry your eyes for you first, and then I'll make so bold as to ask what you have been crying about. When you come to my age, you will find sitting down on the slope of a beach a much longer job than you think it now." By the time I was settled, Rosanna had dried her own eyes with a very inferior handkerchief to mine, cheap cambric. She looked very quiet, and very wretched, but she sat down by me like a good girl, when I told her. When you want to comfort a woman by the shortest way, take her on your knee. I thought of this golden rule. But there. Rosanna wasn't Nancy, and that's the truth of it. "Now, tell me, my dear," I said, "what are you crying about?" "About the years that are gone, Mr. Betteridge," says Rosanna quietly. "My past life still comes back to me sometimes." "Come, come, my girl," I said, "your past life is all sponged out. Why can't you forget it?" She took me by one of the lappets of my coat. I am a slovenly old man, and a good deal of my meat and drink gets splashed about on my clothes. Sometimes one of the women, and sometimes another, cleans me of my grease. The day before, Rosanna had taken out a spot for me on the lappet of my coat, with a new composition, warranted to remove anything. The grease was gone, but there was a little dull place left on the nap of the cloth where the grease had been. The girl pointed to that place, and shook her head. "The stain is taken off," she said. "But the place shows, Mr. Betteridge, the place shows." A remark which takes a man unawares by means of his own coat is not an easy remark to answer. Something in the girl herself, too, made me particularly sorry for her just then. She had nice brown eyes, plain as she was in other ways, and she looked at me with a sort of respect for my happy old age and my good character, as things forever out of her own reach, which made my heart heavy for our second housemaid. Not feeling myself able to comfort her, there was only one other thing to do. That thing was, to take her into dinner. "Help me up," I said. "You're late for dinner, Rosanna, and I have come to fetch you in." "You, Mr. Betteridge," says she. They told Nancy to fetch you, I said. But I thought you might like your scolding better, my dear, if it came from me. Instead of helping me up, the poor thing stole her hand into mine, and gave it a little squeeze. She tried hard to keep from crying again, and succeeded, for which I respected her. You're very kind, Mr. Betteridge, she said. I don't want any dinner today, let me bide a little longer here. What makes you like to be here? I asked. What is it that brings you everlastingly to this miserable place? Something draws me to it, says the girl, making images with her finger in the sand. I try to keep away from it, and I can't. Sometimes, says she in a low voice, as if she was frightened at her own fancy, sometimes, Mr. Betteridge, I think that my grave is waiting for me here. There's roast mutton and suet pudding waiting for you, says I. Go into dinner directly. This is what comes, Rosanna, of thinking on an empty stomach. I spoke severely, being naturally indignant, at my time of life, to hear a young woman of 25 talking about her latter end. She didn't seem to hear me, she put her hand on my shoulder, and kept me where I was, sitting by her side. I think the place has laid a spell on me, she said. I dream of it night after night, I think of it when I sit stitching at my work. You know I am grateful, Mr. Betteridge, you know I try to deserve your kindness, and my lady's confidence in me. But I wonder sometimes whether the life here is too quiet and too good for such a woman as I am, after all I have gone through, Mr. Betteridge, after all I have gone through. It's more lonely to me to be among the other servants, knowing I am not what they are, than it is to be here. My lady doesn't know, the matron at the reformatory doesn't know, what a dreadful reproach honest people are in themselves to a woman like me. Don't scold me, there's a dear good man. I do my work, don't I? Please not to tell my lady I am discontented, I'm not. My mind's unquiet, sometimes, that's all. She snatched her hand off my shoulder, and suddenly pointed down to the quicksand. Look. She said, isn't it wonderful? Isn't it terrible? I have seen it dozens of times, and it's always as new to me as if I had never seen it before. I looked where she pointed. The tide was on the turn, and the horrid sand began to shiver. The broad brown face of it heaved slowly, and then dimpled and quivered all over. Do you know what it looks like to me? Says Rosanna, catching me by the shoulder again. It looks as if it had hundreds of suffocating people under it, all struggling to get to the surface, and all sinking lower and lower in the dreadful deeps. Throw a stone in, Mr. Betteridge. Throw a stone in, and let's see the sand suck it down. Here was unwholesome talk. Here was an empty stomach feeding on an unquiet mind. My answer, a pretty sharp one, in the poor girl's own interests, I promise you, was at my tongue's end, when it was snapped short off on a sudden by a voice among the sandhill shouting for me by my name. Betteridge! Cries the voice, where are you? Here! I shouted out in return, without a notion in my mind of who it was. Rosanna started to her feet, and stood looking towards the voice. I was just thinking of getting on my own legs next, when I was staggered by a sudden change in the girl's face. Her complexion turned of a beautiful red, which I had never seen in it before. She brightened all over with a kind of speechless and breathless surprise. Who is it? I asked. Rosanna gave me back my own question. Oh! Who is it? She said softly, more to herself than to me. I twisted round on the sand and looked behind me. There, coming out on us from among the hills, was a bright-eyed young gentleman, dressed in a beautiful fawn-colored suit, with gloves and hat to match, with a rose in his buttonhole, and a smile on his face that might have set the shivering sand itself smiling at him in return. Before I could get on my legs, he plumped down on the sand by the side of me, put his arm round my neck, foreign fashion, and gave me a hug that fairly squeezed the breath out of my body. Dear old Betteridge, says he, I owe you 7 6. Now do you know who I am? Lord bless us and save us. Here, 4 good hours before we expected him, was Mr. Franklin Blake. Before I could say a word, I saw Mr. Franklin, a little surprised to all appearance, look up from me to Rosanna. Following his lead, I looked at the girl too. She was blushing of a deeper red than ever, seemingly at having caught Mr. Franklin's eye, and she turned and left us suddenly, in a confusion quite unaccountable to my mind, without either making her curtsy to the gentleman or saying a word to me. Very unlike her usual self, a civiler and better behaved servant, in general, you never met with. That's an odd girl, says Mr. Franklin. I wonder what she sees in me to surprise her? I suppose, sir, I answered. Drolling on our young gentleman's continental education, it's the varnish from foreign parts. I set down here Mr. Franklin's careless question, and my foolish answer, as a consolation and encouragement to all stupid people, it being, As I have remarked, a great satisfaction to our inferior fellow creatures to find that their betters are, on occasions, no brighter than they are. Neither Mr. Franklin, with his wonderful foreign training, nor I, with my age, experience, and natural mother wit, had the ghost of an idea of what Rosanna Spearman's unaccountable behavior really meant. She was out of our thoughts, poor soul, before we had seen the last flutter of her little gray cloak among the sandhills. And what of that? You will ask, naturally enough. Read on, good friend, as patiently as you can, and perhaps you will be as sorry for Rosanna Spearman as I was, when I found out the truth. Name equals Chapo 8. Chapter 5. The first thing I did, after we were left together alone, was to make a third attempt to get up from my seat on the sand. Mr. Franklin stopped me. "There is one advantage about this horrid place," he said, "we have got it all to ourselves. Stay where you are, Betteridge, I have something to say to you." While he was speaking, I was looking at him, and trying to see something of the boy I remembered, in the man before me. The man put me out. Look as I might, I could see no more of his boy's rosy cheeks than of his boy's trim little jacket. His complexion had got pale, his face, at the lower part was covered, to my great surprise and disappointment, with a curly brown beard and mustachios. He had a lively touch and go away with him, very pleasant and engaging, I admit, but nothing to compare with his free and easy manners of other times. To make matters worse, he had promised to be tall, and had not kept his promise. He was neat, and slim, and well made, but he wasn't by an inch or two up to the middle height. In short, he baffled me altogether. The years that had passed had left nothing of his old self, except the bright, straightforward look in his eyes. There I found our nice boy again, and there I concluded to stop in my investigation. "Welcome back to the old place, Mr. Franklin," I said. "All the more welcome, sir, that you have come some hours before we expected you." "I have a reason for coming before you expected me," answered Mr. Franklin. "I suspect, Betteridge, that I have been followed and watched in London, for the last 3 or 4 days, and I have traveled by the morning instead of the afternoon train, because I wanted to give a certain dark-looking stranger the slip." Those words did more than surprise me. They brought back to my mind, in a flash, the three jugglers, and Penelope's notion that they meant some mischief to Mr. Franklin Blake. "Who's watching you, sir, and why?" I inquired. "Tell me about the three Indians you have had at the house today," says Mr. Franklin, without noticing my question. "It's just possible, Betteridge, that my stranger and your three jugglers may turn out to be pieces of the same puzzle." "How do you come to know about the jugglers, sir?" I asked, putting one question on the top of another, which was bad manners, I own. "But you don't expect much from poor human nature, so don't expect much from me." "I saw Penelope at the house," says Mr. Franklin, "and Penelope told me. Your daughter promised to be a pretty girl, Betteridge, and she has kept her promise. Penelope has got a small ear and a small foot. Did the late Mrs. Betteridge possess those inestimable advantages?" "The late Mrs. Betteridge possessed a good many defects, sir," says I. "One of them, if you will pardon my mentioning it, was never keeping to the matter in hand. She was more like a fly than a woman, she couldn't settle on anything." "She would just have suited me," says Mr. Franklin. "I never settle on anything either. Betteridge, your edge is better than ever. Your daughter said as much, when I asked for particulars about the jugglers. Father will tell you, sir. He's a wonderful man for his age, and he expresses himself beautifully." Penelope's own words, blushing divinely. "Not even my respect for you prevented me from, never mind, I knew her when she was a child, and she's none the worse for it. Let's be serious. What did the jugglers do?" "I was something dissatisfied with my daughter, not for letting Mr. Franklin kiss her, Mr. Franklin was welcome to that, but for forcing me to tell her foolish story at second hand. However, there was no help for it now but to mention the circumstances. Mr. Franklin's merriment all died away as I went on. He sat knitting his eyebrows, and twisting his beard. When I had done, he repeated after me two of the questions which the chief juggler had put to the boy, seemingly for the purpose of fixing them well in his mind. Is it on the road to this house, and on no other, that the English gentleman will travel today? Has the English gentleman got it about him? I suspect," says Mr. Franklin, pulling a little sealed paper parcel out of his pocket, "that it means this. And this, Betteridge, means my Uncle Herncastle's famous diamond." "Good Lord, sir," I broke out, "how do you come to be in charge of the wicked colonel's diamond?" "The wicked colonel's will has left his diamond as a birthday present to my cousin Rachel," says Mr. Franklin. "And my father, as the wicked colonel's executor, has given it in charge to me to bring down here. If the sea, then oozing in smoothly over the shivering sand, had been changed into dry land before my own eyes, I doubt if I could have been more surprised than I was when Mr. Franklin spoke those words. "The colonel's diamond left to Miss Rachel," says I. "And your father, sir, the colonel's executor. Why, I would have laid any bet you like, Mr. Franklin, that your father wouldn't have touched the colonel with a pair of tongs." Strong language, Betteridge. What was there against the colonel? He belonged to your time, not to mine. Tell me what you know about him, and I'll tell you how my father came to be his executor, and more besides. I have made some discoveries in London about my uncle Herncastle and his diamond, which have rather an ugly look to my eyes, and I want you to confirm them. You called him the wicked colonel just now. Search your memory, my old friend, and tell me why." I saw he was in earnest, and I told him. Here follows the substance of what I said, written out entirely for your benefit. Pay attention to it, or you will be all abroad, when we get deeper into the story. Clear your mind of the children, or the dinner, or the new bonnet, or what not. Try if you can't forget politics, horses, prices in the city, and grievances at the club. I hope you won't take this freedom on my part amiss, it's only a way I have of appealing to the gentle reader. Lord! Haven't I seen you with the greatest authors in your hands, and don't I know how ready your attention is to wander when it's a book that asks for it, instead of a person? I spoke, a little way back, of my lady's father, the old lord with the short temper and the long tongue. He had 5 children in all. 2 sons to begin with, then, after a long time, his wife broke out breeding again, and the 3 young ladies came briskly one after the other, as fast as the nature of things would permit, my mistress, as before mentioned, being the youngest and best of the 3. Of the 2 sons, the eldest, Arthur, inherited the title and estates. The second, the Honorable John, got a fine fortune left him by a relative, and went into the army. It's an ill bird, they say, that fouls its own nest. I look on the noble family of the Herncastles as being my nest, and I shall take it as a favor if I am not expected to enter into particulars on the subject of the Honorable John. He was, I honestly believe, one of the greatest blackguards that ever lived. I can hardly say more or less for him than that. He went into the army, beginning in the guards. He had to leave the guards before he was 22, never mind why. They are very strict in the army, and they were too strict for the Honorable John. He went out to India to see whether they were equally strict there, and to try a little active service. In the matter of bravery, to give him his due, he was a mixture of bulldog and gamecock, with a dash of the savage. He was at the taking of Seringapatam. Soon afterwards he changed into another regiment, and, in course of time, changed into a 3rd. In the 3rd he got his last step as lieutenant colonel, and, getting that, got also a sunstroke, and came home to England. He came back with a character that closed the doors of all his family against him, my lady, then just married, taking the lead, and declaring, with Sir John's approval, of course, that her brother should never enter any house of hers. There was more than one slur on the colonel that made people shy of him, but the blot of the diamond is all I need mention here. It was said he had got possession of his Indian jewel by means which, bold as he was, he didn't dare acknowledge. He never attempted to sell it, not being in need of money, and not, to give him his due again, making money an object. He never gave it away, he never even showed it to any living soul. Some said he was afraid of its getting him into a difficulty with the military authorities, others, very ignorant indeed of the real nature of the man, said he was afraid, if he showed it, of its costing him his life. There was perhaps a grain of truth mixed up with this last report. It was false to say that he was afraid, but it was a fact that his life had been twice threatened in India, and it was firmly believed that the moonstone was at the bottom of it. When he came back to England, and found himself avoided by everybody, the moonstone was thought to be at the bottom of it again. The mystery of the colonel's life got in the colonel's way, and outlawed him, as you may say, among his own people. The men wouldn't let him into their clubs, the women, more than one, whom he wanted to marry, refused him, friends and relations got too near-sighted to see him in the street. Some men in this mess would have tried to set themselves right with the world. But to give in, even when he was wrong, and had all society against him, was not the way of the Honorable John. He had kept the diamond, in flat defiance of assassination, in India. He kept the diamond, in flat defiance of public opinion, in England. There you have the portrait of the man before you, as in a picture, a character that braved everything, and a face, handsome as it was, that looked possessed by the devil. We heard different rumors about him from time to time. Sometimes they said he was given up to smoking opium and collecting old books, sometimes he was reported to be trying strange things in chemistry, sometimes he was seen carousing and amusing himself among the lowest people in the lowest slums of London. Anyhow, a solitary, vicious, underground life was the life the colonel led. Once, and once only, after his return to England, I myself saw him, face to face. About 2 years before the time of which I am now writing, and about a year and a half before the time of his death, the colonel came unexpectedly to my lady's house in London. It was the night of Miss Rachel's birthday, the 21st of June, and there was a party in honor of it, as usual. I received a message from the footman to say that a gentleman wanted to see me. Going up into the hall, there I found the colonel, wasted, and worn, and old, and shabby, and as wild and as wicked as ever. "Go up to my sister," says he, "and say that I have called to wish my niece many happy returns of the day." He had made attempts by letter, more than once already, to be reconciled with my lady, for no other purpose, I am firmly persuaded, than to annoy her. But this was the first time he had actually come to the house. I had it on the tip of my tongue to say that my mistress had a party that night. But the devilish look of him daunted me. I went upstairs with his message, and left him, by his own desire, waiting in the hall. The servant stood staring at him, at a distance, as if he was a walking engine of destruction, loaded with powder and shot, and likely to go off among them at a moment's notice. My lady had a dash, no more, of the family temper. "Tell Colonel Herncastle," she said, when I gave her brother's message, "that Miss Verinder is engaged, and that I decline to see him." I tried to plead for a civiller answer than that, knowing the colonel's constitutional superiority to the restraints which govern gentlemen in general. Quite useless. The family temper flashed out at me directly. "When I want your advice," says my lady, "you know that I always ask for it. I don't ask for it now." I went downstairs with the message, of which I took the liberty of presenting a new and amended edition of my own contriving, as follows: "My lady and Miss Rachel regret that they are engaged, Colonel, and beg to be excused having the honor of seeing you." I expected him to break out, even at that polite way of putting it. To my surprise he did nothing of the sort, he alarmed me by taking the thing with an unnatural quiet. His eyes, of a glittering bright gray, just settled on me for a moment, and he laughed, not out of himself, like other people, but into himself, in a soft, chuckling, horridly mischievous way. "Thank you, Betteridge," he said. "I shall remember my niece's birthday." With that, he turned on his heel, and walked out of the house. The next birthday came round, and we heard he was ill in bed. 6 months afterwards, that is to say, 6 months before the time I am now writing of, there came a letter from a highly respectable clergyman to my lady. It communicated two wonderful things in the way of family news. First, that the colonel had forgiven his sister on his deathbed. Second, that he had forgiven everybody else, and had made a most edifying end. I have myself, in spite of the bishops and the clergy, an unfeigned respect for the church, but I am firmly persuaded, at the same time, that the devil remained in undisturbed possession of the Honorable John, and that the last abominable act in the life of that abominable man was, saving your presence, to take the clergyman in. This was the sum total of what I had to tell Mr. Franklin. I remarked that he listened more and more eagerly the longer I went on. Also, that the story of the colonel being sent away from his sister's door, on the occasion of his niece's birthday, seemed to strike Mr. Franklin like a shot that had hit the mark. Though he didn't acknowledge it, I saw that I had made him uneasy, plainly enough, in his face. "You have said your say, Betteridge," he remarked. "It's my turn now. Before, however, I tell you what discoveries I have made in London, and how I came to be mixed up in this matter of the diamond, I want to know one thing. You look, my old friend, as if you didn't quite understand the object to be answered by this consultation of ours. Do your looks belie you?"
"No, sir," I said. "My looks, on this occasion at any rate, tell the truth."
"In that case," says Mr. Franklin, "suppose I put you up to my point of view, before we go any further. I see three very serious questions involved in the colonel's birthday gift to my cousin Rachel. Follow me carefully, Betteridge, and count me off on your fingers, if it will help you," says Mr. Franklin, with a certain pleasure in showing how clear-headed he could be, which reminded me wonderfully of old times when he was a boy. "Question the first, was the colonel's diamond the object of a conspiracy in India? Question the second, has the conspiracy followed the colonel's diamond to England? Question the third, did the colonel know the conspiracy followed the diamond, and has he purposely left a legacy of trouble and danger to his sister, through the innocent medium of his sister's child? That is what I am driving at, Betteridge. Don't let me frighten you."
It was all very well to say that, but he had frightened me. If he was right, here was our quiet English house suddenly invaded by a devilish Indian diamond, bringing after it a conspiracy of living rogues, set loose on us by the vengeance of a dead man. There was our situation as revealed to me in Mr. Franklin's last words. Whoever heard the like of it, in the 19th century, mind, in an age of progress, and in a country which rejoices in the blessings of the British Constitution. Nobody ever heard the like of it, and, consequently, nobody can be expected to believe it. I shall go on with my story, however, in spite of that. When you get a sudden alarm, of the sort that I had got now, 9 times out of 10 the place you feel it in is your stomach. When you feel it in your stomach, your attention wanders, and you begin to fidget. I fidgeted silently in my place on the sand. Mr. Franklin noticed me, contending with a perturbed stomach or mind, which you please, they mean the same thing, and, checking himself just as he was starting with his part of the story, said to me sharply, "What do you want?" What did I want? I didn't tell him, but I'll tell you, in confidence. I wanted a whiff of my pipe, and a turn at Robinson Crusoe. Name equals Chapo 9. Chapter 6. Keeping my private sentiments to myself, I respectfully requested Mr. Franklin to go on. Mr. Franklin replied, "Don't fidget, Betteridge," and went on. Our young gentleman's first words informed me that his discoveries, concerning the wicked colonel and the diamond, had begun with a visit which he had paid, before he came to us, to the family lawyer, at Hampstead. A chance word dropped by Mr. Franklin, when the two were alone, one day, after dinner, revealed that he had been charged by his father with a birthday present to be taken to Miss Rachel. One thing led to another, and it ended in the lawyer mentioning what the present really was, and how the friendly connection between the late colonel and Mr. Blake, Sr., had taken its rise. The facts here are really so extraordinary, that I doubt if I can trust my own language to do justice to them. I prefer trying to report Mr. Franklin's discoveries, as nearly as may be, in Mr. Franklin's own words. "You remember the time, Betteridge," he said, "when my father was trying to prove his title to that unlucky dukedom. Well, that was also the time when my uncle Herncastle returned from India. My father discovered that his brother-in-law was in possession of certain papers which were likely to be of service to him in his lawsuit. He called on the colonel, on pretense of welcoming him back to England. The colonel was not to be deluded in that way. 'You want something,' he said, 'or you would never have compromised your reputation by calling on me.' My father saw that the one chance for him was to show his hand. He admitted, at once, that he wanted the papers. The colonel asked for a day to consider his answer. His answer came in the shape of a most extraordinary letter, which my friend the lawyer showed me. The colonel began by saying that he wanted something of my father, and that he begged to propose an exchange of friendly services between them. The fortune of war, that was the expression he used, had placed him in possession of one of the largest diamonds in the world, and he had reason to believe that neither he nor his precious jewel was safe in any house, in any quarter of the globe, which they occupied together. Under these alarming circumstances, he had determined to place his diamond in the keeping of another person. That person was not expected to run any risk. He might deposit the precious stone in any place especially guarded and set apart, like a banker's or jeweler's strongroom, for the safe custody of valuables of high price. His main personal responsibility in the matter was to be of the passive kind. He was to undertake either by himself, or by a trustworthy representative, to receive at a prearranged address, on certain prearranged days in every year, a note from the colonel, simply stating the fact that he was a living man at that date. In the event of the date passing over without the note being received, the colonel's silence might be taken as a sure token of the colonel's death by murder. In that case, and in no other, certain sealed instructions relating to the disposal of the diamond, and deposited with it, were to be opened, and followed implicitly. If my father chose to accept this strange charge, the colonel's papers were at his disposal in return. That was the letter. "What did your father do, sir?" I asked. "Do?" says Mr. Franklin. "I'll tell you what he did. He brought the invaluable faculty, called common sense, to bear on the colonel's letter. The whole thing, he declared, was simply absurd. Somewhere in his Indian wanderings, the colonel had picked up with some wretched crystal which he took for a diamond. As for the danger of his being murdered, and the precautions devised to preserve his life and his piece of crystal, this was the 19th century, and any man in his senses had only to apply to the police. The colonel had been a notorious opium eater for years past, and, if the only way of getting at the valuable papers he possessed was by accepting a matter of opium as a matter of fact, my father was quite willing to take the ridiculous responsibility imposed on him, all the more readily that it involved no trouble to himself. The diamond and the sealed instructions went into his banker's strongroom, and the colonel's letters, periodically reporting him a living man, were received and opened by our family lawyer, Mr. Bruff, as my father's representative. No sensible person, in a similar position, could have viewed the matter in any other way. Nothing in this world, Betteridge, is probable unless it appeals to our own trumpery experience, and we only believe in a romance when we see it in a newspaper. It was plain to me from this, that Mr. Franklin thought his father's notion about the colonel hasty and wrong. "What is your own private opinion about the matter, sir?" I asked. "Let's finish the story of the colonel first," says Mr. Franklin. "There is a curious one of system, Betteridge, in the English mind, and your question, my old friend, is an instance of it. When we are not occupied in making machinery, we are, mentally speaking, the most slovenly people in the universe." So much, I thought to myself, for a foreign education. He has learned that way of girding at us in France, I suppose. Mr. Franklin took up the lost thread, and went on. "My father," he said, "got the papers he wanted, and never saw his brother-in-law again from that time. Year after year, on the prearranged days, the prearranged letter came from the colonel, and was opened by Mr. Bruff. I have seen the letters, in a heap, all of them written in the same brief, business-like form of words, 'Sir, this is to certify that I am still a living man. Let the diamond be. John Herncastle.' That was all he ever wrote, and that came regularly to the day, until some 6 or 8 months since, when the form of the letter varied for the first time. It ran now, 'Sir, they tell me I am dying. Come to me, and help me to make my will.' Mr. Bruff went, and found him, in the little suburban villa, surrounded by its own grounds, in which he had lived alone, ever since he had left India. He had dogs, cats, and birds to keep him company, but no human being near him, except the person who came daily to do the housework, and the doctor at the bedside. The will was a very simple matter. The colonel had dissipated the greater part of his fortune in his chemical investigations. His will began and ended in 3 clauses, which he dictated from his bed, in perfect possession of his faculties. The first clause provided for the safekeeping and support of his animals. The second founded a professorship of experimental chemistry at a northern university. The third bequeathed the moonstone as a birthday present to his niece, on condition that my father would act as executor. My father at first refused to act. On second thoughts, however, he gave way, partly because he was assured that the executorship would involve him in no trouble, partly because Mr. Bruff suggested, in Rachel's interest, that the diamond might be worth something, after all. "Did the colonel give any reason, sir," I inquired, "why he left the diamond to Miss Rachel?" "He not only gave the reason, he had the reason written in his will," said Mr. Franklin. "I have got an extract, which you shall see presently. Don't be slovenly minded, Betteridge. One thing at a time. You have heard about the colonel's will, now you must hear what happened after the colonel's death. It was formally necessary to have the diamond valued, before the will could be proved. All the jewelers consulted, at once confirmed the colonel's assertion that he possessed one of the largest diamonds in the world. The question of accurately valuing it presented some serious difficulties. Its size made it a phenomenon in the diamond market, its color placed it in a category by itself, and, to add to these elements of uncertainty, there was a defect, in the shape of a flaw, in the very heart of the stone. Even with this last serious drawback, however, the lowest of the various estimates given was £20,000. Conceive my father's astonishment. He had been within a hair's breadth of refusing to act as executor, and of allowing this magnificent jewel to be lost to the family. The interest he took in the matter now, induced him to open the sealed instructions which had been deposited with the diamond. Mr. Bruff showed this document to me, with the other papers, and it suggests, to my mind, a clue to the nature of the conspiracy which threatened the colonel's life. "Then you do believe, sir," I said, "that there was a conspiracy?" "Not possessing my father's excellent common sense," answered Mr. Franklin, "I believe the colonel's life was threatened, exactly as the colonel said. The sealed instructions, as I think, explain how it was that he died, after all, quietly in his bed. In the event of his death by violence, that is to say, in the absence of the regular letter from him at the appointed date, my father was then directed to send the moonstone secretly to Amsterdam. It was to be deposited in that city with a famous diamond cutter, and it was to be cut up into from 4 to 6 separate stones. The stones were then to be sold for what they would fetch, and the proceeds were to be applied to the founding of that professorship of experimental chemistry, which the colonel has since endowed by his will. Now, Betteridge, exert those sharp wits of yours, and observe the conclusion to which the colonel's instructions point." I instantly exerted my wits. They were of the slovenly English sort, and they consequently muddled it all, until Mr. Franklin took them in hand, and pointed out what they ought to see. "Remark," says Mr. Franklin, "that the integrity of the diamond, as a whole stone, is here artfully made dependent on the preservation from violence of the colonel's life. He is not satisfied with saying to the enemies he dreads, 'Kill me, and you will be no nearer to the diamond than you are now, it is where you can't get at it, in the guarded strong room of a bank.' He says instead, 'Kill me, and the diamond will be the diamond no longer, its identity will be destroyed.' What does that mean?" Here I had, as I thought, a flash of the wonderful foreign brightness. "I know," I said. "It means lowering the value of the stone, and cheating the rogues in that way." "Nothing of the sort," says Mr. Franklin. "I have inquired about that. The flawed diamond, cut up, would actually fetch more than the diamond as it now is, for this plain reason, that from 4 to 6 perfect brilliants might be cut from it, which would be, collectively, worth more money than the large, but imperfect single stone. If robbery for the purpose of gain was at the bottom of the conspiracy, the colonel's instructions absolutely made the diamond better worth stealing. More money could have been got for it, and the disposal of it in the diamond market would have been infinitely easier, if it had passed through the hands of the workmen of Amsterdam." "Lord bless us, sir," I burst out. "What was the plot, then?" "A plot organized among the Indians who originally owned the jewel," says Mr. Franklin, "a plot with some old Hindu superstition at the bottom of it. That is my opinion, confirmed by a family paper which I have about me at this moment." I saw, now, why the appearance of the three Indian jugglers at our house had presented itself to Mr. Franklin in the light of a circumstance worth noting. "I don't want to force my opinion on you," Mr. Franklin went on. "The idea of certain chosen servants of an old Hindu superstition devoting themselves, through all difficulties and dangers, to watching the opportunity of recovering their sacred gem, appears to me to be perfectly consistent with everything that we know of the patience of Oriental races, and the influence of Oriental religions. But then I'm an imaginative man, and the butcher, the baker, and the tax gatherer, are not the only credible realities in existence to my mind. Let the guess I have made at the truth in this matter go for what it is worth, and let us get on to the only practical question that concerns us. Does the conspiracy against the Moonstone survive the colonel's death? And did the colonel know it, when he left the birthday gift to his niece?" I began to see my lady and Miss Rachel at the end of it all, now. Not a word he said escaped me. "I was not very willing, when I discovered the story of the Moonstone," said Mr. Franklin, "to be the means of bringing it here. But Mr. Brough reminded me that somebody must put my cousin's legacy into my cousin's hands, and that I might as well do it as anybody else. After taking the diamond out of the bank, I fancied I was followed in the streets by a shabby, dark-complexioned man. I went to my father's house to pick up my luggage, and found a letter there, which unexpectedly detained me in London. I went back to the bank with the diamond, and thought I saw the shabby man again. Taking the diamond once more out of the bank this morning, I saw the man for the third time, gave him the slip, and started, before he recovered the trace of me, by the morning instead of the afternoon train. Here I am, with the diamond safe and sound, and what is the first news that meets me? I find that three strolling Indians have been at the house, and that my arrival from London, and something which I am expected to have about me, are two special objects of investigation to them when they believe themselves to be alone. I don't waste time and words on their pouring the ink into the boy's hand, and telling him to look in it for a man at a distance, and for something in that man's pocket. The thing, which I have often seen done in the East, is hocus-pocus in my opinion, as it is in yours. The present question for us to decide is, whether I am wrongly attaching a meaning to a mere accident? Or whether we really have evidence of the Indians being on the track of the Moonstone, the moment it is removed from the safekeeping of the bank? Neither he nor I seemed to fancy dealing with this part of the inquiry. We looked at each other, and then we looked at the tide, oozing in smoothly, higher and higher, over the shivering sand. "What are you thinking of?" says Mr. Franklin, suddenly. "I was thinking, sir," I answered, "that I should like to shy the diamond into the quicksand, and settle the question in that way." "If you have got the value of the stone in your pocket," answered Mr. Franklin, "say so, Betteridge, and in it goes. It's curious to note, when your mind's anxious, how very far in the way of relief a very small joke will go. We found a fund of merriment, at the time, in the notion of making away with Miss Rachel's lawful property, and getting Mr. Blake, as executor, into dreadful trouble, though where the merriment was, I am quite at a loss to discover now." Mr. Franklin was the first to bring the talk back to the talk's proper purpose. He took an envelope out of his pocket, opened it, and handed to me the paper inside. Betteridge, he said, we must face the question of the Colonel's motive in leaving this legacy to his niece, for my aunt's sake. Bear in mind how Lady Verinder treated her brother from the time when he returned to England, to the time when he told you he should remember his niece's birthday. And read that. He gave me the extract from the Colonel's will. I have got it by me while I write these words, and I copy it, as follows, for your benefit. Thirdly, and lastly, I give and bequeath to my niece, Rachel Verinder, daughter and only child of my sister, Julia Verinder, widow, if her mother, the said Julia Verinder, shall be living on the said Rachel Verinder's next birthday after my death, the yellow diamond belonging to me, and known in the East by the name of the Moonstone, subject to this condition, that her mother, the said Julia Verinder, shall be living at the time. And I hereby desire my executor to give my diamond, either by his own hands or by the hands of some trustworthy representative whom he shall appoint, into the personal possession of my said niece Rachel, on her next birthday after my death, and in the presence, if possible, of my sister, the said Julia Verinder. And I desire that my said sister may be informed, by means of a true copy of this, the third and last clause of my will, that I give the diamond to her daughter Rachel, in token of my free forgiveness of the injury which her conduct towards me has been the means of inflicting on my reputation in my lifetime, and especially in proof that I pardon, as becomes a dying man, the insult offered to me as an officer and a gentleman, when her servant, by her orders, closed the door of her house against me, on the occasion of her daughter's birthday. More words follow these, providing if my lady was dead, or if Miss Rachel was dead, at the time of the testator's decease, for the diamond being sent to Holland, in accordance with the sealed instructions originally deposited with it. The proceeds of the sale were, in that case, to be added to the money already left by the will for the professorship of chemistry at the university in the north. I handed the paper back to Mr. Franklin, sorely troubled what to say to him. Up to that moment, my own opinion had been, as you know, that the Colonel had died as wickedly as he had lived. I don't say the copy from his will actually converted me from that opinion, I only say it staggered me. Well, says Mr. Franklin, now you have read the Colonel's own statement, what do you say? In bringing the Moonstone to my aunt's house, am I serving his vengeance blindfold, or am I vindicating him in the character of a penitent and Christian man? It seems hard to say, sir, I answered, that he died with a horrid revenge in his heart, and a horrid lie on his lips. God alone knows the truth. Don't ask me. Mr. Franklin sat twisting and turning the extract from the will in his fingers, as if he expected to squeeze the truth out of it in that manner. He altered quite remarkably, at the same time. From being brisk and bright, he now became, most unaccountably, a slow, solemn, and pondering young man. This question has two sides, he said. An objective side, and a subjective side. Which are we to take? He had had a German education as well as a French. One of the two had been an undisturbed possession of him, as I supposed, up to this time. And now, as well as I could make out, the other was taking its place. It is one of my rules in life, never to notice what I don't understand. I steered a middle course between the objective side and the subjective side. In plain English I stared hard, and said nothing. Let's extract the inner meaning of this, says Mr. Franklin. Why did my uncle leave the diamond to Rachel? Why didn't he leave it to my aunt? That's not beyond guessing, sir, at any rate, I said. Colonel Herncastle knew my lady well enough to know that she would have refused to accept any legacy that came to her from him. How did he know that Rachel might not refuse to accept it, too? Is there any young lady in existence, sir, who could resist the temptation of accepting such a birthday present as the Moonstone? That's the subjective view, says Mr. Franklin. It does you great credit, Betteridge, to be able to take the subjective view. But there's another mystery about the Colonel's legacy which is not accounted for yet. How are we to explain his only giving Rachel her birthday present conditionally on her mother being alive? I don't want to slander a dead man, sir, I answered. But if he has purposely left a legacy of trouble and danger to his sister, by the means of her child, it must be a legacy made conditional on his sister's being alive to feel the vexation of it. Oh! That's your interpretation of his motive, is it? The subjective interpretation again. Have you ever been in Germany, Betteridge? No, sir. What's your interpretation, if you please? I can see, says Mr. Franklin, that the Colonel's object may, quite possibly, have been, not to benefit his niece, whom he had never even seen, but to prove to his sister that he had died forgiving her, and to prove it very prettily by means of a present made to her child. There is a totally different explanation from yours, Betteridge, taking its rise in a subjective-objective point of view. From all I can see, one interpretation is just as likely to be right as the other. Having brought matters to this pleasant and comforting issue, Mr. Franklin appeared to think that he had completed all that was required of him. He lay down flat on his back on the sand, and asked what was to be done next. He had been so clever, and clear-headed, before he began to talk the foreign gibberish, and had so completely taken the lead in the business up to the present time, that I was quite unprepared for such a sudden change as he now exhibited in this helpless leaning upon me. It was not till later that I learned, by assistance of Miss Rachel, who was the first to make the discovery, that these puzzling shifts and transformations in Mr. Franklin were due to the effect on him of his foreign training. At the age when we are all of us most apt to take our coloring, in the form of a reflection from the coloring of other people, he had been sent abroad, and had been passed on from one nation to another, before there was time for any one coloring more than another to settle itself on him firmly. As a consequence of this, he had come back with so many different sides to his character, all more or less jarring with each other, that he seemed to pass his life in a state of perpetual contradiction with himself. He could be a busy man, and a lazy man, cloudy in the head, and clear in the head, a model of determination, and a spectacle of helplessness, all together. He had his French side, and his German side, and his Italian side, the original English foundation showing through, every now and then, as much as to say, "Here I am, sorely transmogrified, as you see, but there's something of me left at the bottom of him still." Miss Rachel used to remark that the Italian side of him was uppermost, on those occasions when he unexpectedly gave in, and asked you in his nice sweet-tempered way to take his own responsibilities on your shoulders. You will do him no injustice, I think, if you conclude that the Italian side of him was uppermost now. "Isn't it your business, sir," I asked, "to know what to do next? Surely it can't be mine?" Mr. Franklin didn't appear to see the force of my question, not being in a position, at the time, to see anything but the sky over his head. "I don't want to alarm my aunt without reason," he said. "And I don't want to leave her without what may be a needful warning. If you were in my place, Betteridge, tell me, in one word, what would you do?" "In one word," I told him, "wait." "With all my heart," says Mr. Franklin. "How long?" I proceeded to explain myself. "As I understand it, sir," I said, "somebody is bound to put this plaguey diamond into Miss Rachel's hands on her birthday, and you may as well do it as another." "Very good. This is the 25th of May, and the birthday is on the 21st of June. We have got close on 4 weeks before us. Let's wait and see what happens in that time, and let's warn my lady, or not, as the circumstances direct us." "Perfect, Betteridge, as far as it goes," says Mr. Franklin. "But between this and the birthday, what's to be done with the diamond?"
"What your father did with it, to be sure, sir," I answered.
"Your father put it in the safekeeping of a bank in London. You put in the safekeeping of the bank at Frizinghall. Frizinghall was our nearest town, and the Bank of England wasn't safer than the bank there. If I were you, sir," I added, "I would ride straight away with it to Frizinghall before the ladies come back. The prospect of doing something, and, what is more, of doing that something on a horse, brought Mr. Franklin up like lightning from the flat of his back. He sprang to his feet, and pulled me up, without ceremony, onto mine. 'Betteridge, you are worth your weight in gold,' he said. 'Come along, and saddle the best horse in the stables directly.' Here, God bless it, was the original English foundation of him showing through all the foreign varnish at last. Here was the Master Franklin I remembered, coming out again in the good old way at the prospect of a ride, and reminding me of the good old times. Saddle a horse for him? I would have saddled a dozen horses, if he could only have ridden them all. We went back to the house in a hurry. We had the fleetest horse in the stable saddled in a hurry, and Mr. Franklin rattled off in a hurry, to lodge the cursed diamond once more in the strong room of a bank. When I heard the last of his horse's hoofs on the drive, and when I turned about in the yard and found I was alone again, I felt half inclined to ask myself if I hadn't woke up from a dream. Name equals chap 10. Chapter 7. While I was in this bewildered frame of mind, sorely needing a little quiet time by myself to put me right again, my daughter Penelope got in my way, just as her late mother used to get in my way on the stairs, and instantly summoned me to tell her all that had passed at the conference between Mr. Franklin and me. Under present circumstances, the one thing to be done was to clap the extinguisher upon Penelope's curiosity on the spot. I accordingly replied that Mr. Franklin and I had both talked of foreign politics, till we could talk no longer, and had then mutually fallen asleep in the heat of the sun. Try that sort of answer when your wife or your daughter next worries you with an awkward question at an awkward time, and depend on the natural sweetness of women for kissing and making it up again at the next opportunity. The afternoon wore on, and my lady and Miss Rachel came back. Needless to say how astonished they were, when they heard that Mr. Franklin Blake had arrived, and had gone off again on horseback. Needless also to say, that they asked awkward questions directly, and that the foreign politics and the falling asleep in the sun wouldn't serve a second time over with them. Being at the end of my invention, I said Mr. Franklin's arrival by the early train was entirely attributable to one of Mr. Franklin's freaks. Being asked, upon that, whether his galloping off again on horseback was another of Mr. Franklin's freaks, I said, yes, it was, and slipped out of it, I think very cleverly, in that way. Having got over my difficulties with the ladies, I found more difficulties waiting for me when I went back to my own room. In came Penelope, with the natural sweetness of women, to kiss and make it up again, and, with the natural curiosity of women, to ask another question. This time she only wanted me to tell her what was the matter with our second housemaid, Rosanna Spearman. After leaving Mr. Franklin and me at the Shivering Sand, Rosanna, it appeared, had returned to the house in a very unaccountable state of mind. She had turned, if Penelope was to be believed, all the colors of the rainbow. She had been merry without reason, and sad without reason. In one breath she asked hundreds of questions about Mr. Franklin Blake, and in another breath she had been angry with Penelope for presuming to suppose that a strange gentleman could possess any interest for her. She had been surprised, smiling, and scribbling Mr. Franklin's name inside her workbox. She had been surprised again, crying and looking at her deformed shoulder in the glass. Had she and Mr. Franklin known anything of each other before today? Quite impossible. Had they heard anything of each other? Impossible again. I could speak to Mr. Franklin's astonishment as genuine, when he saw how the girl stared at him. Penelope could speak to the girl's inquisitiveness as genuine, when she asked questions about Mr. Franklin. The conference between us, conducted in this way, was tiresome enough, until my daughter suddenly ended it by bursting out with what I thought the most monstrous supposition I had ever heard in my life. "Father," says Penelope, quite seriously, "there's only one explanation of it. Rosanna has fallen in love with Mr. Franklin Blake at first sight." You have heard of beautiful young ladies falling in love at first sight, and have thought it natural enough. But a housemaid out of a reformatory, with a plain face and a deformed shoulder, falling in love, at first sight, with a gentleman who comes on a visit to her mistress's house, match me that, in the way of an absurdity, out of any storybook in Christendom, if you can. I laughed till the tears rolled down my cheeks. Penelope resented my merriment, in rather a strange way. "I never knew you cruel before, father," she said, very gently, and went out. My girl's words fell upon me like a splash of cold water. I was savage with myself, for feeling uneasy in myself the moment she had spoken them, but so it was. We will change the subject, if you please. I am sorry I drifted into writing about it, and not without reason, as you will see when we have gone on together a little longer. The evening came, and the dressing bell for dinner rang, before Mr. Franklin returned from Frizinghall. I took his hot water up to his room myself, expecting to hear, after this extraordinary delay, that something had happened. To my great disappointment, and no doubt to yours also, nothing had happened. He had not met with the Indians, either going or returning. He had deposited the moonstone in the bank, describing it merely as a valuable of great price, and he had got the receipt for it safe in his pocket. I went downstairs, feeling that this was rather a flat ending, after all our excitement about the diamond earlier in the day. How the meeting between Mr. Franklin and his aunt and cousin went off, is more than I can tell you. I would have given something to have waited at table that day. But, in my position in the household, waiting at dinner, except on high family festivals, was letting down my dignity in the eyes of the other servants, a thing which my lady considered me quite prone enough to do already, without seeking occasions for it. The news brought to me from the upper regions, that evening, came from Penelope and the footman. Penelope mentioned that she had never known Miss Rachel so particular about the dressing of her hair, and had never seen her look so bright and pretty as she did when she went down to meet Mr. Franklin in the drawing room. The footman's report was, that the preservation of a respectful composure in the presence of his betters, and the waiting on Mr. Franklin Blake at dinner, were two of the hardest things to reconcile with each other that had ever tried his training in service. Later in the evening, we heard them singing and playing duets, Mr. Franklin piping high, Miss Rachel piping higher, and my lady, on the piano, following them as it were over hedge and ditch, and seeing them safe through it in a manner most wonderful and pleasant to hear through the open windows, on the terrace at night. Later still, I went to Mr. Franklin in the smoking room, with the soda water and brandy, and found that Miss Rachel had put the diamond clean out of his head. "She's the most charming girl I have seen since I came back to England," was all I could extract from him, when I endeavored to lead the conversation to more serious things. Towards midnight, I went round the house to lock up, accompanied by my second-in-command, Samuel, the footman, as usual. When all the doors were made fast, except the side door that opened on the terrace, I sent Samuel to bed, and stepped out for a breath of fresh air before I too went to bed in my turn. The night was still and close, and the moon was at the full in the heavens. It was so silent out of doors, that I heard from time to time, very faint and low, the fall of the sea, as the ground swell heaved it in on the sandbank near the mouth of our little bay. As the house stood, the terrace side was the dark side, but the broad moonlight showed fair on the gravel walk that ran along the next side to the terrace. Looking this way, after looking up at the sky, I saw the shadow of a person in the moonlight thrown forward from behind the corner of the house. Being old and sly, I forbore to call out, but being also, unfortunately, old and heavy, my feet betrayed me on the gravel. Before I could steal suddenly round the corner, as I had proposed, I heard lighter feet than mine, and more than one pair of them as I thought, retreating in a hurry. By the time I had got to the corner, the trespassers, whoever they were, had run into the shrubbery at the off side of the walk, and were hidden from sight among the thick trees and bushes in that part of the grounds. From the shrubbery, they could easily make their way, over our fence into the road. If I had been 40 years younger, I might have had a chance of catching them before they got clear of our premises. As it was, I went back to set a-going a younger pair of legs than mine. Without disturbing anybody, Samuel and I got a couple of guns, and went all round the house and through the shrubbery. Having made sure that no persons were lurking about anywhere in our grounds, we turned back. Passing over the walk where I had seen the shadow, I now noticed, for the first time, a little bright object, lying on the clean gravel, under the light of the moon. Picking the object up, I discovered it was a small bottle, containing a thick sweet-smelling liquor, as black as ink. I said nothing to Samuel. But, remembering what Penelope had told me about the jugglers, and the pouring of the little pool of ink into the palm of the boy's hand, I instantly suspected that I had disturbed the three Indians, lurking about the house, and bent, in their heathenish way, on discovering the whereabouts of the diamond that night. Name equals Chap 11. Chapter 8. Here, for one moment, I find it necessary to call a halt. On summoning up my own recollections, and on getting Penelope to help me, by consulting her journal, I find that we may pass pretty rapidly over the interval between Mr. Franklin Blake's arrival and Miss Rachel's birthday. For the greater part of that time the days passed, and brought nothing with them worth recording. With your good leave, then, and with Penelope's help, I shall notice certain dates only in this place, reserving to myself to tell the story day by day, once more, as soon as we get to the time when the business of the moonstone became the chief business of everybody in our house. This said, we may now go on again, beginning, of course, with the bottle of sweet-smelling ink which I found on the gravel walk at night. On the next morning, the morning of the 26th, I showed Mr. Franklin this article of jugglery, and told him what I have already told you. His opinion was, not only that the Indians had been lurking about after the diamond, but also that they were actually foolish enough to believe in their own magic, meaning thereby the making of signs on a boy's head, and the pouring of ink into a boy's hand, and then expecting him to see persons and things beyond the reach of human vision. In our country, as well as in the East, Mr. Franklin informed me, there are people who practice this curious hocus-pocus, without the ink, however, and who call it by a French name, signifying something like brightness of sight. Depend upon it, says Mr. Franklin, the Indians took it for granted that we should keep the diamond here, and they brought their clairvoyant boy to show them the way to it, if they succeeded in getting into the house last night. Do you think they'll try again, sir? I asked. It depends, says Mr. Franklin, on what the boy can really do. If he can see the diamond through the iron safe of the bank at Frizinghall, we shall be troubled with no more visits from the Indians for the present. If he can't, we shall have another chance of catching them in the shrubbery, before many more nights are over our heads. I waited pretty confidently for that latter chance, but, strange to relate, it never came. Whether the jugglers heard, in the town, of Mr. Franklin having been seen at the bank, and drew their conclusions accordingly, or whether the boy really did see the diamond where the diamond was now lodged, which I, for one, flatly disbelieve, or whether, after all, it was a mere effect of chance, this at any rate is the plain truth, not the ghost of an Indian came near the house again, through the weeks that passed before Miss Rachel's birthday. The jugglers remained in and about the town plying their trade, and Mr. Franklin and I remained waiting to see what might happen, and resolute not to put the rogues on their guard by showing our suspicions of them too soon. With this report of the proceedings on either side, ends all that I have to say about the Indians for the present. On the 29th of the month, Miss Rachel and Mr. Franklin hit on a new method of working their way together through the time which might otherwise have hung heavy on their hands. There are reasons for taking particular notice here of the occupation that amused them. You will find it has a bearing on something that is still to come. Gentlefolks in general have a very awkward rock ahead in life, the rock ahead of their own idleness. Their lives being, for the most part, passed in looking about them for something to do, it is curious to see, especially when their tastes are of what is called the intellectual sort, how often they drift blindfold into some nasty pursuit. 9 times out of 10 they take to torturing something, or to spoiling something, and they firmly believe they are improving their minds, when the plain truth is, they are only making a mess in the house. I have seen them, ladies, I am sorry to say, as well as gentlemen, go out, day after day, for example, with empty pillboxes, and catch newts, and beetles, and spiders, and frogs, and come home and stick pins through the miserable wretches, or cut them up, without a pang of remorse, into little pieces. You see my young master, or my young mistress, poring over one of their spiders' insides with a magnifying glass, or you meet one of their frogs walking downstairs without his head, and when you wonder what this cruel nastiness means, you are told that it means a taste in my young master or my young mistress for natural history. Sometimes, again, you see them occupied for hours together in spoiling a pretty flower with pointed instruments, out of a stupid curiosity to know what the flower is made of. Is its color any prettier, or its scent any sweeter, when you do know? But there. The poor souls must get through the time, you see, they must get through the time. You dabbled in nasty mud, and made pies, when you were a child, and you dabble in nasty science, and dissect spiders, and spoil flowers, when you grow up. In the one case and in the other, the secret of it is, that you have got nothing to think of in your poor empty head, and nothing to do with your poor idle hands. And so it ends in your spoiling canvas with paints, and making a smell in the house, or in keeping tadpoles in a glass box full of dirty water, and turning everybody's stomach in the house, or in chipping off bits of stone here, there, and everywhere, and dropping grit into all the victuals in the house, or in staining your fingers in the pursuit of photography, and doing justice without mercy on everybody's face in the house. It often falls heavy enough, no doubt, on people who are really obliged to get their living, to be forced to work for the clothes that cover them, the roof that shelters them, and the food that keeps them going. But compare the hardest day's work you ever did with the idleness that splits flowers and pokes its way into spiders' stomachs, and thank your stars that your head has got something it must think of, and your hands something that they must do. As for Mr. Franklin and Miss Rachel, they tortured nothing, I am glad to say. They simply confined themselves to making a mess, and all they spoilt, to do them justice, was the paneling of a door. Mr. Franklin's universal genius, dabbling in everything, dabbled in what he called decorative painting. He had invented, he informed us, a new mixture to moisten paint with, which he described as a vehicle. What it was made of, I don't know. What it did, I can tell you in 2 words, it stank. Miss Rachel being wild to try her hand at the new process, Mr. Franklin sent to London for the materials, mixed them up, with accompaniment of a smell which made the very dogs sneeze when they came into the room, put an apron and a bib over Miss Rachel's gown, and set her to work decorating her own little sitting room, called, for one of English to name it in, her boudoir. They began with the inside of the door. Mr. Franklin scraped off all the nice varnish with pumice stone, and made what he described as a surface to work on. Miss Rachel then covered the surface, under his directions and with his help, with patterns and devices, griffins, birds, flowers, cupids, and such like, copied from designs made by a famous Italian painter, whose name escapes me, the one, I mean, who stocked the world with Virgin Maries, and had a sweetheart at the baker's. Viewed as work, this decoration was slow to do, and dirty to deal with. But our young lady and gentleman never seemed to tire of it. When they were not riding, or seeing company, or taking their meals, or piping their songs, there they were with their heads together, as busy as bees, spoiling the door. Who was the poet who said that Satan finds some mischief still for idle hands to do? If he had occupied my place in the family, and had seen Miss Rachel with her brush, and Mr. Franklin with his vehicle, he could have written nothing truer of either of them than that. The next date worthy of notice is Sunday the 4th of June. On that evening we, in the servants' hall, debated a domestic question for the first time, which, like the decoration of the door, has its bearing on something that is still to come. seeing the pleasure which Mr. Franklin and Miss Rachel took in each other's society, and noting what a pretty match they were in all personal respects, we naturally speculated on the chance of their putting their heads together with other objects in view besides the ornamenting of a door. Some of us said there would be a wedding in the house before the summer was over. Others, led by me, admitted it was likely enough Miss Rachel might be married, but we doubted, for reasons which will presently appear, whether her bridegroom would be Mr. Franklin Blake. That Mr. Franklin was in love, on his side, nobody who saw and heard him could doubt. The difficulty was to fathom Miss Rachel. Let me do myself the honor of making you acquainted with her, after which, I will leave you to fathom for yourself, if you can. My young lady's 18th birthday was the birthday now coming, on the 21st of June. If you happen to like dark women, who, I am informed, have gone out of fashion latterly in the gay world, and if you have no particular prejudice in favor of size, I answer for Miss Rachel as one of the prettiest girls your eyes ever looked on. She was small and slim, but all in fine proportion from top to toe. To see her sit down, to see her get up, and specially to see her walk, was enough to satisfy any man in his senses that the graces of her figure, if you will pardon me the expression, were in her flesh and not in her clothes. Her hair was the blackest I ever saw. Her eyes matched her hair. Her nose was not quite large enough, I admit. Her mouth and chin were, to quote Mr. Franklin, morsels for the gods, and her complexion, on the same undeniable authority, was as warm as the sun itself, with this great advantage over the sun, that it was always a nice order to look at. Add to the foregoing that she carried her head as upright as a dart, in a dashing, spirited, thoroughbred way, that she had a clear voice, with the ring of the right metal in it, and a smile that began very prettily in her eyes before it got to her lips, and there behold a portrait of her, to the best of my painting, as large as life. And what about her disposition next? Had this charming creature no faults? She had just as many faults as you have, ma'am, neither more nor less. To put it seriously, my dear pretty Miss Rachel, possessing a host of graces and attractions, had one defect, which strict impartiality compels me to acknowledge. She was unlike most other girls of her age, in this, that she had ideas of her own, and was stiff-necked enough to set the fashions themselves at defiance, if the fashions didn't suit her views. In trifles, this independence of hers was all well enough, but in matters of importance, it carried her, as my lady thought, and as I thought, too far. She judged for herself, as few women of twice her age judge in general, never asked your advice, never told you beforehand what she was going to do, never came with secrets and confidences to anybody, from her mother downwards. In little things and great, with people she loved, and people she hated, and she did both with equal heartiness, Miss Rachel always went on a way of her own, sufficient for herself in the joys and sorrows of her life. Over and over again I have heard my lady say, Rachel's best friend and Rachel's worst enemy are, one and the other, Rachel herself. Add one thing more to this, and I have done. With all her secrecy, and self-will, there was not so much as the shadow of anything false in her. I never remember her breaking her word, I never remember her saying no, and meaning yes. I can call to mind, in her childhood, more than one occasion when the good little soul took the blame, and suffered the punishment, for some fault committed by a playfellow whom she loved. Nobody ever knew her to confess to it, when the thing was found out, and she was charged with it afterwards. But nobody ever knew her to lie about it, either. She looked you straight in the face, and shook her little saucy head, and said plainly, I won't tell you. Punished again for this, she would own to being sorry for saying won't, but, bread and water notwithstanding, she never told you. Self-willed, devilish self-willed sometimes, I grant, but the finest creature, nevertheless, that ever walked the ways of this lower world. Perhaps you think you see a certain contradiction here? In that case, a word in your ear. Study your wife closely, for the next 24 hours. If your good lady doesn't exhibit something in the shape of a contradiction in that time, heaven help you. You have married a monster. I have now brought you acquainted with Miss Rachel, which you will find puts us face to face, next, with the question of that young lady's matrimonial views. On June the 12th, an invitation from my mistress was sent to a gentleman in London, to come and help to keep Miss Rachel's birthday. This was the fortunate individual on whom I believed her heart to be privately set. Like Mr. Franklin, he was a cousin of hers. His name was Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite. My lady's second sister, don't be alarmed, we are not going very deep into family matters this time, my lady's second sister, I say, had a disappointment in love, and taking a husband afterwards, on the neck or nothing principle, made what they call a misalliance. There was terrible work in the family when the Honorable Caroline insisted on marrying plain Mr. Abel White, the banker at Frizinghall. He was very rich and very respectable, and he begot a prodigious large family, all in his favor, so far. But he had presumed to raise himself from a low station in the world, and that was against him. However, time and the progress of modern enlightenment put things right, and the misalliance passed muster very well. We are all getting liberal now, and, provided you can scratch me, if I scratch you, what do I care, in or out of Parliament, whether you are a dustman or a duke? That's the modern way of looking at it, and I keep up with the modern way. The Abel Whites lived in a fine house and grounds, a little out of Frizinghall. Very worthy people, and greatly respected in the neighborhood. We shall not be much troubled with them in these pages, excepting Mr. Godfrey, who was Mr. Abel White's second son, and who must take his proper place here, if you please, for Miss Rachel's sake. With all his brightness and cleverness and general good qualities, Mr. Franklin's chance of topping Mr. Godfrey in our young lady's estimation was, in my opinion, a very poor chance indeed. In the first place, Mr. Godfrey was, in point of size, the finest man by far of the two. He stood over 6 feet high, he had a beautiful red and white color, a smooth round face, shaved as bare as your hand, and a head of lovely long flaxen hair, falling negligently over the pole of his neck. But why do I try to give you this personal description of him? If you ever subscribe to a ladies' charity in London, you know Mr. Godfrey Abel White as well as I do. He was a barrister by profession, a ladies' man by temperament, and a good Samaritan by choice. Female benevolence and female destitution could do nothing without him. Maternal societies for confining poor women, Magdalen societies for rescuing poor women, strong-minded societies for putting poor women into poor men's places, and leaving the men to shift for themselves, he was vice president, manager, referee to them all. Wherever there was a table with a committee of ladies sitting round it in council, there was Mr. Godfrey at the bottom of the board, keeping the temper of the committee, and leading the dear creatures along the thorny ways of business, hat in hand. I do suppose this was the most accomplished philanthropist, on a small independence, that England ever produced. As a speaker at charitable meetings, the like of him for drawing your tears and your money was not easy to find. He was quite a public character. The last time I was in London, my mistress gave me 2 treats. She sent me to the theatre to see a dancing woman who was all the rage, and she sent me to Exeter Hall to hear Mr. Godfrey. The lady did it, with a band of music. The gentleman did it, with a handkerchief and a glass of water. Crowds at the performance with the legs. Ditto at the performance with the tongue. And with all this, the sweetest-tempered person, I allude to Mr. Godfrey, the simplest and pleasantest and easiest to please, you ever met with. He loved everybody. And everybody loved him. What chance had Mr. Franklin, what chance had anybody of average reputation and capacities, against such a man as this? On the 14th, came Mr. Godfrey's answer. He accepted my mistress's invitation, from the Wednesday of the birthday to the evening of Friday, when his duties to the ladies' charities would oblige him to return to town. He also enclosed a copy of verses on what he elegantly called his cousin's natal day. Miss Rachel, I was informed, joined Mr. Franklin in making fun of the verses at dinner, and Penelope, who was all on Mr. Franklin's side, asked me, in great triumph, what I thought of that. Miss Rachel has led you off on a false scent, my dear, I replied, but my nose is not so easily mystified. Wait till Mr. Abel White's verses are followed by Mr. Abel White himself. My daughter replied, that Mr. Franklin might strike in, and try his luck, before the verses were followed by the poet. In favor of this view, I must acknowledge that Mr. Franklin left no chance untried of winning Miss Rachel's good graces. Though one of the most inveterate smokers I ever met with, he gave up his cigar, because she said, one day, she hated the stale smell of it in his clothes. He slept so badly, after this effort of self-denial, for want of the composing effect of the tobacco to which he was used, and came down morning after morning looking so haggard and worn, that Miss Rachel herself begged him to take to his cigars again. No. He would take to nothing again that could cause her a moment's annoyance, he would fight it out resolutely, and get back his sleep, sooner or later, by main force of patience in waiting for it. Such devotion as this, you may say, as some of them said downstairs, could never fail of producing the right effect on Miss Rachel, backed up, too, as it was, by the decorating work every day on the door. All very well, but she had a photograph of Mr. Godfrey in her bedroom, represented speaking at a public meeting, with all his hair blown out by the breath of his own eloquence, and his eyes, most lovely, charming the money out of your pockets. What do you say to that? Every morning, as Penelope herself owned to me, There was the man whom the women couldn't do without, looking on, in effigy, while Miss Rachel was having her hair combed. He would be looking on, in reality, before long, that was my opinion of it. June the 16th brought an event which made Mr. Franklin's chance look, to my mind, a worse chance than ever. A strange gentleman, speaking English with a foreign accent, came that morning to the house, and asked to see Mr. Franklin Blake on business. The business could not possibly have been connected with the diamond, for these two reasons: first, that Mr. Franklin told me nothing about it; secondly, that he communicated it, when the gentleman had gone, as I suppose, to my lady. She probably hinted something about it next to her daughter. At any rate, Miss Rachel was reported to have said some severe things to Mr. Franklin, at the piano that evening, about the people he had lived among, and the principles he had adopted in foreign parts. The next day, for the first time, nothing was done towards the decoration of the door. I suspect some imprudence of Mr. Franklin's on the continent, with a woman or a debt at the bottom of it, had followed him to England. But that is all guesswork. In this case, not only Mr. Franklin, but my lady too, for a wonder, left me in the dark. On the 17th, to all appearance, the cloud passed away again. They returned to their decorating work on the door, and seemed to be as good friends as ever. If Penelope was to be believed, Mr. Franklin had seized the opportunity of the reconciliation to make an offer to Miss Rachel, and had neither been accepted nor refused. My girl was sure, from signs and tokens which I need not trouble you with, that her young mistress had fought Mr. Franklin off by declining to believe that he was in earnest, and had then secretly regretted treating him in that way afterwards. Though Penelope was admitted to more familiarity with her young mistress than maids generally are, for the two had been almost brought up together as children, still I knew Miss Rachel's reserved character too well to believe that she would show her mind to anybody in this way. What my daughter told me, on the present occasion, was, as I suspected, more what she wished than what she really knew. On the 19th another event happened. We had the doctor in the house professionally. He was summoned to prescribe for a person whom I have had occasion to present to you in these pages, our second housemaid, Rosanna Spearman. This poor girl, who had puzzled me, as you know already, at the Shivering Sand, puzzled me more than once again, in the interval time of which I am now writing. Penelope's notion that her fellow servant was in love with Mr. Franklin, which my daughter, by my orders, kept strictly secret, seemed to be just as absurd as ever. But I must own that what I myself saw, and what my daughter saw also, of our second housemaid's conduct, began to look mysterious, to say the least of it. For example, the girl constantly put herself in Mr. Franklin's way, very slyly and quietly, but she did it. He took about as much notice of her as he took of the cat. It never seemed to occur to him to waste a look on Rosanna's plain face. The poor thing's appetite, never much, fell away dreadfully, and her eyes in the morning showed plain signs of waking and crying at night. One day Penelope made an awkward discovery, which we hushed up on the spot. She caught Rosanna at Mr. Franklin's dressing table, secretly removing a rose which Miss Rachel had given him to wear in his buttonhole, and putting another rose like it, of her own picking, in its place. She was, after that, once or twice impudent to me, when I gave her a well-meant general hint to be careful in her conduct, and, worse still, she was not over-respectful now, on the few occasions when Miss Rachel accidentally spoke to her. My lady noticed the change, and asked me what I thought about it. I tried to screen the girl by answering that I thought she was out of health, and it ended in the doctor being sent for, as already mentioned, on the 19th. He said it was her nerves, and doubted if she was fit for service. My lady offered to remove her for change of air to one of our farms, inland. She begged and prayed, with the tears in her eyes, to be let to stop, and, in an evil hour, I advised my lady to try her for a little longer. As the event proved, and as you will soon see, this was the worst advice I could have given. If I could only have looked a little way into the future, I would have taken Rosanna Spearman out of the house, then and there, with my own hand. On the 20th, there came a note from Mr. Godfrey. He had arranged to stop at Frizinghall that night, having occasion to consult his father on business. On the afternoon of the next day, he and his two eldest sisters would ride over to us on horseback, in good time before dinner. An elegant little casket in China accompanied the note, presented to Miss Rachel, with her cousin's love and best wishes. Mr. Franklin had only given her a plain locket not worth half the money. My daughter Penelope, nevertheless, such is the obstinacy of women, still backed him to win. Thanks be to heaven, we have arrived at the eve of the birthday at last. You alone, I think, that I have got you over the ground this time, without much loitering by the way. Cheer up. I leave you with another new chapter here, And, what is more, that chapter shall take you straight into the thick of the story. Name equals chap 12. Chapter 9. June 21st, the day of the birthday, was cloudy and unsettled at sunrise, but towards noon it cleared up bravely. We, in the servants' hall, began this happy anniversary, as usual, by offering our little presents to Miss Rachel, with the regular speech delivered annually by me as the chief. I follow the plan adopted by the Queen in opening Parliament, namely, the plan of saying much the same thing regularly every year. Before it is delivered, my speech, like the Queen's, is looked for as eagerly as if nothing of the kind had ever been heard before. When it is delivered, and turns out not to be the novelty anticipated, though they grumble a little, they look forward hopefully to something newer next year. Uneasy people to govern, in the Parliament and in the kitchen, that's the moral of it. After breakfast, Mr. Franklin and I had a private conference on the subject of the Moonstone, the time having now come for removing it from the bank at Frizinghall, and placing it in Miss Rachel's own hands. Whether he had been trying to make love to his cousin again, and had got a rebuff, or whether his broken rest, night after night, was aggravating the queer contradictions and uncertainties in his character, I don't know. But certain it is, that Mr. Franklin failed to show himself at his best on the morning of the birthday. He was in 20 different minds about the diamond in as many minutes. For my part, I stuck fast by the plain facts as we knew them. Nothing had happened to justify us in alarming my lady on the subject of the jewel, and nothing could alter the legal obligation that now lay on Mr. Franklin to put it in his cousin's possession. That was my view of the matter, and, twist and turn it as he might, he was forced in the end to make it his view too. We arranged that he was to ride over, after lunch, to Frizinghall, and bring the diamond back, with Mr. Godfrey and the two young ladies, in all probability, to keep him company on the way home again. This settled, our young gentlemen went back to Miss Rachel. They consumed the whole morning, and part of the afternoon, in the everlasting business of decorating the door, Penelope standing by to mix the colors, as directed, and my lady, as luncheon time drew near, going in and out of the room, with her handkerchief to her nose, for they used a deal of Mr. Franklin's vehicle that day, and trying vainly to get the two artists away from their work. It was 3 o'clock before they took off their aprons, and released Penelope, much the worse for the vehicle, and cleaned themselves of their mess. But they had done what they wanted, they had finished the door on the birthday, and proud enough they were of it. The griffins, cupids, and so on, were, I must own, most beautiful to behold, though so many in number, so entangled in flowers and devices, and so topsy-turvy in their actions and attitudes, that you felt them unpleasantly in your head for hours after you had done with the pleasure of looking at them. If I add that Penelope ended her part of the morning's work by being sick in the back kitchen, it is in no unfriendly spirit towards the vehicle. No. No. It left off stinking when it dried, and if art requires these sort of sacrifices, though the girl is my own daughter, I say, let art have them. Mr. Franklin snatched a morsel from the luncheon table, and rode off to Frizinghall, to escort his cousins, as he told my lady, to fetch the Moonstone, as was privately known to himself and to me. This being one of the high festivals on which I took my place at the sideboard, in command of the attendants at table, I had plenty to occupy my mind while Mr. Franklin was away. Having seen to the wine, and reviewed my men and women who were to wait at dinner, I retired to collect myself before the company came. A whiff of, you know what, and a turn at a certain book which I have had occasion to mention in these pages, composed me, body and mind. I was aroused from what I am inclined to think must have been, not a nap, but a reverie, by the clatter of horses' hoofs outside, and, going to the door, received a cavalcade comprising Mr. Franklin and his three cousins, escorted by one of old Mr. Ablewhite's grooms. Mr. Godfrey struck me, strangely enough, as being like Mr. Franklin in this respect, that he did not seem to be in his customary spirits. He kindly shook hands with me as usual, and was most politely glad to see his old friend Betteridge wearing so well. But there was a sort of cloud over him, which I couldn't at all account for, and when I asked how he had found his father in health, he answered rather shortly, much as usual. However, the two Miss Ablewhites were cheerful enough for 20, which more than restored the balance. They were nearly as big as their brother, spanking, yellow-haired, rosy lasses, overflowing with superabundant flesh and blood, bursting from head to foot with health and spirits. The legs of the poor horses trembled with carrying them, and when they jumped from their saddles, without waiting to be helped, I declare they bounced on the ground as if they were made of India rubber. Everything the Miss Ablewhite said began with a large O, everything they did was done with a bang, and they giggled and screamed, in season and out of season, on the smallest provocation. Bouncers, that's what I call them. Under cover of the noise made by the young ladies, I had an opportunity of saying a private word to Mr. Franklin in the hall. "Have you got the diamond safe, sir?" He nodded, and tapped the breast pocket of his coat. "Have you seen anything of the Indians?" "Not a glimpse." With that answer, he asked for my lady, and, hearing she was in the small drawing room, went there straight. The bell rang, before he had been a minute in the room, and Penelope was sent to tell Miss Rachel that Mr. Franklin Blake wanted to speak to her. Crossing the hall, about half an hour afterwards, I was brought to a sudden standstill by an outbreak of screams from the small drawing room. I can't say I was at all alarmed, for I recognized in the screams the favorite large O of the Miss Ablewhites. However, I went in, on pretense of asking for instructions about the dinner, to discover whether anything serious had really happened. There stood Miss Rachel at the table, like a person fascinated, with the Colonel's unlucky diamond in her hand. There, on either side of her, knelt the two bouncers, devouring the jewel with their eyes, and screaming with ecstasy every time it flashed on them in a new light. There, at the opposite side of the table, stood Mr. Godfrey, clapping his hands like a large child, and singing out softly, "Exquisite! Exquisite!" There sat Mr. Franklin in a chair by the bookcase, tugging at his beard, and looking anxiously towards the window. And there, at the window, stood the object he was contemplating, my lady, having the extract from the Colonel's will in her hand, and keeping her back turned on the whole of the company. She faced me, when I asked for my instructions, and I saw the family frown gathering over her eyes, and the family temper twitching at the corners of her mouth. "Come to my room in half an hour," she answered. "I shall have something to say to you then." With those words, she went out. It was plain enough that she was posed by the same difficulty which had posed Mr. Franklin and me in our conference at the Shivering Sand. Was the legacy of the Moonstone a proof that she had treated her brother with cruel injustice? Or was it a proof that he was worse than the worst she had ever thought of him? Serious questions those for my lady to determine, while her daughter, innocent of all knowledge of the Colonel's character, stood there with the Colonel's birthday gift in her hand. Before I could leave the room in my turn, Miss Rachel, always considerate to the old servant who had been in the house when she was born, stopped me. "Look, Gabriel," she said, and flashed the jewel before my eyes in a ray of sunlight that poured through the window. Lord bless us! It was a diamond. As large, or nearly, as a plover's egg. The light that streamed from it was like the light of the harvest moon. When you looked down into the stone, you looked into a yellow deep that drew your eyes into it so that they saw nothing else. It seemed unfathomable, this jewel, that you could hold between your finger and thumb, seemed unfathomable as the heavens themselves. We set it in the sun, and then shut the light out of the room, and it shone awfully out of the depths of its own brightness, with a moony gleam, in the dark. No wonder Miss Rachel was fascinated, no wonder her cousins screamed. The diamond laid such a hold on me that I burst out with as large an O as the bouncers themselves. The only one of us who kept his senses was Mr. Godfrey. He put an arm round each of his sister's waists, and, looking compassionately backwards and forwards between the diamond and me, said, "Carbon Betteridge. Mere carbon, my good friend, after all." His object, I suppose, was to instruct me. All he did, however, was to remind me of the dinner. I hobbled off to my army of waiters downstairs. As I went out, Mr. Godfrey said, "Dear old Betteridge, I have the truest regard for him." He was embracing his sisters, and ogling Miss Rachel, while he honored me with that testimony of affection. Something like a stock of love to draw on there. Mr. Franklin was a perfect savage by comparison with him. At the end of half an hour, I presented myself, as directed, in my lady's room. What passed between my mistress and me, on this occasion, was, in the main, a repetition of what had passed between Mr. Franklin and me at the Shivering Sand, with this difference, that I took care to keep my own counsel about the jugglers, seeing that nothing had happened to justify me in alarming my lady on this head. When I received my dismissal, I could see that she took the blackest view possible of the Colonel's motives, and that she was bent on getting the Moonstone out of her daughter's possession at the first opportunity. On my way back to my own part of the house, I was encountered by Mr. Franklin. He wanted to know if I had seen anything of his cousin Rachel. I had seen nothing of her. Could I tell him where his cousin Godfrey was? I didn't know, but I began to suspect that Cousin Godfrey might not be far away from Cousin Rachel. Mr. Franklin's suspicions apparently took the same turn. He tugged hard at his beard, and went and shut himself up in the library with a bang of the door that had a world of meaning in it. I was interrupted no more in the business of preparing for the birthday dinner till it was time for me to smarten myself up for receiving the company. Just as I had got my white waistcoat on, Penelope presented herself at my toilet, on pretense of brushing what little hair I have got left, and improving the tie of my white cravat. My girl was in high spirits, and I saw she had something to say to me. She gave me a kiss on the top of my bald head, and whispered, "News for you, father. Miss Rachel has refused him."
"Who's him?" question mark I asked.
"The ladies' committee man, father," says Penelope. "A nasty sly fellow. I hate him for trying to supplant Mr. Franklin." If I had had breath enough, I should certainly have protested against this indecent way of speaking of an eminent philanthropic character. But my daughter happened to be improving the tie of my cravat at that moment, and the whole strength of her feelings found its way into her fingers. I never was more nearly strangled in my life. "I saw him take her away alone into the rose garden," says Penelope. "And I waited behind the holly to see how they came back. They had gone out arm in arm, both laughing. They came back, walking separate, as grave as grave could be, and looking straight away from each other in a manner which there was no mistaking. I never was more delighted, father, in my life. There's one woman in the world who can resist Mr. Godfrey Ablewhite, at any rate, and, if I was a lady, I should be another." Here I should have protested again. But my daughter had got the hairbrush by this time, and the whole strength of her feelings had passed into that. If you are bald, you will understand how she sacrificed me. If you are not, skip this bit, and thank God you have got something in the way of a defense between your hairbrush and your head. "Just on the other side of the holly," Penelope went on, "Mr. Godfrey came to a standstill. 'You prefer,' says he, 'that I should stop here as if nothing had happened?' Miss Rachel turned on him like lightning. 'You have accepted my mother's invitation,' she said, 'and you are here to meet her guests. Unless you wish to make a scandal in the house, you will remain, of course.' She went on a few steps, and then seemed to relent a little. 'Let us forget what has passed, Godfrey,' she said, 'and let us remain cousins still.' She gave him her hand. He kissed it, which I should have considered taking a liberty, and then she left him. He waited a little by himself, with his head down, and his heel grinding a hole slowly in the gravel walk. You never saw a man look more put out in your life. Awkward," he said between his teeth, when he looked up, and went on to the house, "very awkward." If that was his opinion of himself, he was quite right. Awkward enough, I'm sure. "And the end of it is, father, what I told you all along," cries Penelope, finishing me off with a last scarification, the hottest of all. "Mr. Franklin's the man." I got possession of the hairbrush, and opened my lips to administer the reproof which, you will own, my daughter's language and conduct richly deserved. Before I could say a word, the crash of carriage wheels outside struck in, and stopped me. The first of the dinner company had come. Penelope instantly ran off. I put on my coat, and looked in the glass. My head was as red as a lobster, but, in other respects, I was as nicely dressed for the ceremonies of the evening as a man need be. I got into the hall just in time to announce the two first of the guests. You needn't feel particularly interested about them. Only the philanthropist's father and mother, Mr. and Mrs. Ablewhite. Name equals chap 13. Chapter 10. One on the top of the other, the rest of the company followed the Ablewhites, till we had the whole tale of them complete. Including the family, they were 24 in all. It was a noble sight to see, when they were settled in their places round the dinner table, and the rector of Frizinghall, with beautiful elocution, rose and said grace. There is no need to worry you with a list of the guests. You will meet none of them a second time, in my part of the story, at any rate, with the exception of two. Those two sat on either side of Miss Rachel, who, as queen of the day, was naturally the great attraction of the party. On this occasion she was more particularly the center point towards which everybody's eyes were directed, for, to my lady's secret annoyance, she wore her wonderful birthday present, which eclipsed all the rest, the moonstone. It was without any setting when it had been placed in her hands, but that universal genius, Mr. Franklin, had contrived, with the help of his neat fingers and a little bit of silver wire, to fix it as a brooch in the bosom of her white dress. Everybody wondered at the prodigious size and beauty of the diamond, as a matter of course. But the only two of the company who said anything out of the common way about it were those two guests I have mentioned, who sat by Miss Rachel on her right hand and her left. The guest on her left was Mr. Candy, our doctor at Frizinghall. This was a pleasant, companionable little man, with the drawback, however, I must own, of being too fond, in season and out of season, of his joke, and of his plunging in rather a headlong manner into talk with strangers, without waiting to feel his way first. In society, he was constantly making mistakes, and setting people unintentionally by the ears together. In his medical practice he was a more prudent man, picking up his discretion, as his enemies said, by a kind of instinct, and proving to be generally right where more carefully conducted doctors turned out to be wrong. What he said about the diamond to Miss Rachel was said, as usual, by way of a mystification or joke. He gravely entreated her, in the interests of science, to let him take it home and burn it. "We will first heat it, Miss Rachel," says the doctor, "to such and such a degree, then we will expose it to a current of air, and, little by little, puff, we evaporate the diamond, and spare you a world of anxiety about the safekeeping of a valuable precious stone." My lady, listening with rather a careworn expression on her face, seemed to wish that the doctor had been in earnest, and that he could have found Miss Rachel zealous enough in the cause of science to sacrifice her birthday gift. The other guest, who sat on my young lady's right hand, was an eminent public character, being no other than the celebrated Indian traveler, Mr. Murthwaite, who, at risk of his life, had penetrated into skies where no European had ever set foot before. This was a long, lean, wiry, brown, silent man. He had a weary look, and a very steady, attentive eye. It was rumored that he was tired of the humdrum life among the people in our parts, and longing to go back and wander off on the tramp again in the wild places of the East. Except what he said to Miss Rachel about her jewel, I doubt if he spoke six words or drank so much as a single glass of wine, all through the dinner. The moonstone was the only object that interested him in the smallest degree. The fame of it seemed to have reached him, in some of those perilous Indian places where his wanderings had lain. After looking at it silently for so long a time that Miss Rachel began to get confused, he said to her in his cool, immovable way, "If you ever go to India, Mississippi, Verinder, don't take your uncle's birthday gift with you. A Hindu diamond is sometimes part of a Hindu religion. I know a certain city, and a certain temple in that city, where, dressed as you are now, your life would not be worth 5 minutes' purchase." Miss Rachel, safe in England, was quite delighted to hear of her danger in India. The bouncers were more delighted still. They dropped their knives and forks with a crash, and burst out together vehemently, "Oh! How interesting!" My lady fidgeted in her chair, and changed the subject. As the dinner got on, I became aware, little by little, that this festival was not prospering as other like festivals had prospered before it. Looking back at the birthday now, by the light of what happened afterwards, I am half inclined to think that the cursed diamond must have cast a blight on the whole company. I plied them well with wine, and being a privileged character, followed the unpopular dishes round the table, and whispered to the company confidentially, "Please to change your mind and try it, for I know it will do you good." 9 times out of 10 they changed their minds, out of regard for their old original beverage, they were pleased to say, but all to no purpose. There were gaps of silence in the talk, as the dinner got on, that made me feel personally uncomfortable. When they did use their tongues again, they used them innocently, in the most unfortunate manner and to the worst possible purpose. Mr. Candy, the doctor, for instance, said more unlucky things than I ever knew him to say before. Take one sample of the way in which he went on, and you will understand what I had to put up with at the sideboard, officiating as I was in the character of a man who had the prosperity of the festival at heart. One of our ladies present at dinner was worthy Mrs. Threadgill, widow of the late professor of that name. Talking of her deceased husband perpetually, this good lady never mentioned to strangers that he was deceased. She thought, I suppose, that every able-bodied adult in England ought to know as much as that. In one of the gaps of silence, somebody mentioned the dry and rather nasty subject of human anatomy, whereupon good Mrs. Threadgill straightway brought in her late husband as usual, without mentioning that he was dead. Anatomy she described as the professor's favorite recreation in his leisure hours. As ill luck would have it, Mr. Candy, sitting opposite, who knew nothing of the deceased gentleman, heard her. Being the most polite of men, he seized the opportunity of assisting the professor's anatomical amusements on the spot. "They have got some remarkably fine skeletons lately at the College of Surgeons," says Mr. Candy, across the table, in a loud cheerful voice. "I strongly recommend the professor, ma'am, when he next has an hour to spare, to pay them a visit. You might have heard a pin fall." The company, out of respect to the professor's memory, all sat speechless. I was behind Mrs. Threadgill at the time, plying her confidentially with a glass of hock. She dropped her head, and said in a very low voice, "My beloved husband is no more." Unluckily Mr. Candy, hearing nothing, and miles away from suspecting the truth, went on across the table louder and politer than ever. "The professor may not be aware," says he, "that the card of a member of the college will admit him, on any day but Sunday, between the hours of 10 and 4. Mrs. Threadgill dropped her head right into her tucker, and, in a lower voice still, repeated the solemn words, "My beloved husband is no more." I winked hard at Mr. Candy across the table. Miss Rachel touched his arm. My lady looked unutterable things at him. Quite useless. On he went, with a cordiality that there was no stopping anyhow. I shall be delighted, says he, to send the professor my card, if you will oblige me by mentioning his present address. His present address, sir, is the grave, says Mrs. Threadgall, suddenly losing her temper, and speaking with an emphasis and fury that made the glasses ring again. The professor has been dead these 10 years.
Oh, good heavens! Says Mr. Candy. Excepting the bouncers, who burst out laughing, such a blank now fell on the company, that they might all have been going the way of the professor, and hailing as he did from the direction of the grave. So much for Mr. Candy. The rest of them were nearly as provoking in their different ways as the doctor himself. When they ought to have spoken, they didn't speak, or when they did speak they were perpetually at cross purposes. Mr. Godfrey, though so eloquent in public, declined to exert himself in private. Whether he was sulky, or whether he was bashful, after his discomfiture in the rose garden, I can't say. He kept all his talk for the private ear of the lady, a member of our family, who sat next to him. She was one of his committee women, a spiritually minded person, with a fine show of collarbone and a pretty taste in champagne, liked it dry, you understand, and plenty of it. Being close behind these two at the sideboard, I can testify, from what I heard pass between them, that the company lost a good deal of very improving conversation, which I caught up while drawing the corks, and carving the mutton, and so forth. What they said about their charities I didn't hear. When I had time to listen to them, they had got a long way beyond their women to be confined, and their women to be rescued, and were disputing on serious subjects. Religion, I understand Mr. Godfrey to say, between the corks and the carving, meant love. And love meant religion. And earth was heaven a little the worse for wear. And heaven was earth, done up again to look like new. Earth had some very objectionable people in it, but, to make amends for that, all the women in heaven would be members of a prodigious committee that never quarreled, with all the men in attendance on them as ministering angels. Beautiful. Beautiful. But why the mischief did Mr. Godfrey keep it all to his lady and himself? Mr. Franklin again, surely, you will say, Mr. Franklin stirred the company up into making a pleasant evening of it? Nothing of the sort. He had quite recovered himself, and he was in wonderful force and spirits, Penelope having informed him, I suspect, of Mr. Godfrey's reception in the Rose Garden. But, talk as he might, 9 times out of 10 he pitched on the wrong subject, or he addressed himself to the wrong person, the end of it being that he offended some, and puzzled all of them. That foreign training of his, those French and German and Italian sides of him, to which I have already alluded, came out, at my lady's hospitable board, in a most bewildering manner. What do you think, for instance, of his discussing the lengths to which a married woman might let her admiration go for a man who was not her husband, and putting it in his clear-headed witty French way to the maiden aunt of the vicar of Frizinghall? What do you think, when he shifted to the German side, of his telling the lord of the manor, while that great authority on cattle was quoting his experience in the breeding of bulls, that experience, properly understood, counted for nothing, and that the proper way to breed bulls was to look deep into your own mind, evolve out of it the idea of a perfect bull, and produce him? What do you say, when our county member, growing hot, at cheese and salad time, about the spread of democracy in England, burst out as follows, if we once lose our ancient safeguards, Mr. Blake, I beg to ask you, what have we got left? What do you say to Mr. Franklin answering, from the Italian point of view, we have got 3 things left, sir, love, music, and salad. He not only terrified the company with such outbreaks as these, but, when the English side of him turned up in due course, he lost his foreign smoothness, and, getting on the subject of the medical profession, said such downright things in ridicule of doctors, that he actually put good humor little Mr. Candy in a rage. The dispute between them began in Mr. Franklin being led, I forget how, to acknowledge that he had latterly slept very badly at night. Mr. Candy thereupon told him that his nerves were all out of order and that he ought to go through a course of medicine immediately. Mr. Franklin replied that a course of medicine, and a course of groping in the dark, meant, in his estimation, one and the same thing. Mr. Candy, hitting back smartly, said that Mr. Franklin himself was, constitutionally speaking, groping in the dark after sleep, and that nothing but medicine could help him to find it. Mr. Franklin, keeping the ball up on his side, said he had often heard of the blind leading the blind, and now, for the first time, he knew what it meant. In this way, they kept it going briskly, cut and thrust, till they both of them got hot, Mr. Candy, in particular, so completely losing his self-control,
in defense of his profession, that my lady was obliged to interfere, and forbid the dispute to go on. This necessary act of authority put the last extinguisher on the spirits of the company. The talk spurted up again here and there, for a minute or two at a time, but there was a miserable lack of life and sparkle in it. The devil, or the diamond, possessed that dinner party, and it was a relief to everybody when my mistress rose, and gave the ladies the signal to leave the gentlemen over their wine. I had just ranged the decanters in a row before old Mr. Ablewhite, who represented the master of the house, when there came a sound from the terrace which startled me out of my company manners on the instant.